1947, NASA launched the last of America's deep space probes. Aboard this compact starship, a lone astronaut, Captain William Buck Rogers, was to experience cosmic forces beyond all comprehension. In a freak mishap, his life support systems were frozen by temperatures beyond imagination. Ranger 3 was blown out of its planned trajectory into an orbit 1,000 times more vast, an orbit which was to return Buck Rogers to Earth 500 years later.
Hola.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
Pretty good.
It's Super Bowl Sunday, and we're talking retro comics and stuff.
Indeed. What time is the Super Bowl on?
I think it's 4 or 6. I can't remember. Barb, what time is the Super Bowl? 4:30. But that would be 6:30 your time.
Right, yeah.
Are you going anywhere?
No, I'm not really that excited about it or anything.
Yeah, I'm just rooting that the Broncos lose, that's it.
Yeah, I'm just happy that the Patriots got eliminated.
I was rooting for the Patriots. I hate to do that. It's bad being a Bills fan and rooting for them, but... God, I don't like the Broncos that much.
I was pretty surprised that your level of hatred of the Broncos was intense enough to get you to root for the Patriots. I mean, I don't know if everyone out there understands that, but for a Bills fan to root for the Patriots, I mean...
It's not a good thing.
I was checking for other signs of the apocalypse. I was a little nervous.
Yeah.
But if I sound a little stuffy, it probably won't last. I just
You just got up?
No, I've been up for like 3 hours. But I just put my contacts in and I washed my hands, but I don't think I washed them good enough, and I think I had a little bit of jalapeno juice on my hands still.
I was just gonna say that.
So I put my contact in, all of a sudden it started burning. I was like, oh shit.
Did you have jalapenos with breakfast or what?
Yeah, actually. Well, I had them on my... I didn't eat breakfast right away. So I ate right... Well, I'm still actually kind of eating, but... Because I knew I would get too hungry. I think one of the first couple times we recorded, I didn't eat anything till after the podcast and I almost fell over. But... So I learned my lesson, make sure I eat something. Because I'm real good about, I eat breakfast during the week, but on the weekend, sometimes I'm lazy about eating. I'll just drink coffee in the morning, and I'll end up eating lunch at like 11.
Yeah.
I don't know why that is, but...
That's what happens when you just eat like leaves and stuff. You need more leaves, or you don't have anything to sustain yourself, and you pass out just talking.
Yeah, you know, because I don't have those heavy breakfasts of like meat and eggs and stuff like that. So where I could eat that, and then pass out, take a nap because my body needs to recuperate from everything I just put in it, and so I stay awake, and so then I need more food to sustain myself.
That's true. Evidence of that is Daryl. He always has his eyes closed.
Yeah. When I ate meat, I used to like chicken finger subs.
Yeah.
And I would eat them despite the fact that I knew that I would feel like crap afterwards.
Yeah.
Because they were so good but so heavy, and I always felt tired afterwards and sometimes sick to my stomach.
That's
maybe
unusual.
It was the place I was getting it from. I don't know. but
yeah, it sounds like they're slowly poisoning you.
They were secretly turning me into a vegetarian.
Yeah, so this is a sinus episode because I'm nasally too.
Yeah, I think we usually are.
I just ate an egg sandwich with bacon.
Up here, it's pretty common to have sinus issues.
Yeah.
Around our area, everybody's got post-nasal drip or something, or allergies, or
allergic to the snow.
Yeah. I don't know. Is that around like that around there?
Yeah, there's a lot of allergies here.
Yeah, because like, I know, like, just like south of you, in New Mexico and Arizona, like that tends to be less common, doesn't it? Just
yeah, because it's dry.
So dry, yeah. That sounds awesome. So I don't know. Do I sound all right? I'm actually using. I got a new headset.
Yeah, you sound fine.
That's cool. I got a.
You sound like somebody that had jalapenos in his eyes.
Yeah.
It's like yeah. HD effect.
Yeah. I mentioned last time how I had a laptop, but I ended up recording from the desktop because my old headsets that I've used prior to this episode had regular. It wasn't a USB.
Uh-huh.
But I think because the sound card on my desktop was good enough to compensate for it.
Yeah.
But then as soon as I plugged those headsets into the laptop with the different sound card, I could tell a difference. It sounded real funny. So I knew from listening to DC Noise that I shouldn't get an expensive microphone.
Other pretentious ones?
Yeah, I didn't want to get the like Chris Campbell or Daryl Taylor version
because yeah.
They seem problematic, so I just spent $20.
Yeah, that's all you need. That's all you need.
Yeah, on a USB headset. So
we've seen what those other fancy things can do.
I know, I was nervous, so I don't want to try that. I don't wanna take the bathroom break and have be able to
hear the urine.
Yeah. In case you left the recording going and people could hear like my anus clenching or something.
Yeah, your sphincter. There you go.
Like, what's that popping noise?
Yeah.
So, this is episode 20-something?
Six.
26. Of Geek Brunch Retrocast. I'm here with my co-host, Wet Eagle Daddy.
That's me.
And I am Dick Pritchett.
Dick Pritchett. There you go.
And we're going to talk about Wet Wilma Deering.
Yes. Sexy Wilma Deering in a dress. Was she wearing a blue dress? I can't remember. I remember the other one was an orange one, and I loved the orange dress because the slit on the thigh went all the way up to the waist.
Yeah.
It was like way up there. I was like, damn. Those slaves.
Yeah, they were like slave dresses.
Sexy, sexy.
I mean, honestly, if you're going to call the episode Planet of the Slave Girls, there has to be some sexy or.
Yeah.
It's like false advertising.
There could have been more slave girls. There was just.
Yeah.
I was expecting more. I remember parts of this episode.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've seen it when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I do remember Jack Palance and the red hands.
Yeah.
And I remember that fight scene because I was like, how does Twiggy fly that thing? You know? He just doesn't seem like a kid.
Mm-hmm.
But this one was another two-parter. So you had told me that last episode. I remember you said, do you want to just do the next two because it's a two-parter? And I said, yeah. And then I was playing it. I was like, wow, that's an hour and 50 minutes. And I was like, oh, yeah, it's that. That's when I texted you. And you said, well, it's a two-parter. And then I remembered.
Yeah, because when you watch them on the DVDs, I know at least the one I have, it just plays through like it's one long episode. There's no, you know, it doesn't, you don't have to see the credit opening again or anything.
Right, right.
Just like the first one we covered did. This
one had like a lot of stars. It had Jack Palance as Khalil. He was the main bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
It had Buster Crabtree, which is freaking awesome because Buster Crabtree is known for playing Buck Rogers in the original serial, and also Flash Gordon. He was a character in the Flash Gordon serial.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
He was actually Gordon, Brigadier Gordon, in the original serial. So the old guy that came out of retirement was actually Buck Rogers in the past, and they threw a lot of like Easter eggs at that, you know, just verbally.
Yeah. Yeah, that was neat because in the circumstances, you know, they're having to scrape together a real you know, a force from people that are just available because most of the people are sick. So he comes out of retirement, the character that he plays.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of a call to outside of the episode kind of circumstances.
Right. And the other big actor who I like a lot, mostly from Fright Night, is Roddy McDowall.
he
was also in it.
Yeah, and also the woman that played Rima, her name is Breanne Leary, and she was she's also known for being a regular on Chips.
Nice. She was hot. Like, I was like, wow.
Mm-hmm.
She's pretty sexy.
I looked it up on Wikipedia, and I was showing Kara because I thought it was pretty funny. She, like, later on in life, got into doing inventing, and she invented this device called the paw plunger.
Yeah.
And it's a thing that you, like, stick your pet's paw in to clean it real fast.
Yeah.
Like, when they come from outside or something. And
oh, God.
You, like, if you look that up, you know, there's pictures of her on the website with her dog and stuff. And then one other actor that was in it that was kind of a staple of TV at the time was the guy that played Duke Danton. His name's David Groh, and he was a regular on the TV show Rhoda.
I never watched Rhoda, but I'm aware of it.
Yeah, same here.
I stayed away from Rhoda and like Mary Tyler Moore, you know, some of those other shows.
Yeah.
Bob Newhart. I just never got into them.
Yeah, I mean, they're kind of before my time. I know Newhart was something that my parents, they liked to watch him. Rhoda, I think, was a spinoff of Mary Tyler Moore, right?
Yeah, I think so. And that's probably why I didn't watch it. But I did watch a lot of comedies, you know, at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I just was more into, like, the Archie Bunker and All in the Family and the Jeffersons and Three's Company and stuff like that.
Yeah. But, so should we get into the plot then?
Yeah.
Of Planet of the Slave Girls, Part 1 and 2. I forget exactly how the episode starts, but
it starts with a guy, one of the pilots getting really, really sick. Like,
right.
They're out in space, they're flying, he's like sweating, he can't control his plane. The Major Duke Danton's screaming bloody murder at him, like, what the fuck is wrong with you? And Buck Rogers comes in for the save, essentially, and it forms an uncomfortable situation between him and Buck. And then there's also, like, somewhat of a sexual thing because Wilma used to date this guy.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And it's Wilma and Buck are out just, I don't know if they're coming back from a mission or just flying around, but Duke is running his pilots through training and Buck and Wilma mistake it for actual danger. So there's a little bit of tension there because they interrupted Duke's training and stuff. And so when they get back to planet, everybody lands and stuff, and the soldier that's sick gets taken away. Wilma ends up suggesting that Buck do a training exercise for Duke's pilots and stuff that he's in charge of. And it's kind of significant that Wilma is superior to Duke. You know, like they were in class together, but
she's a colonel and he's a major.
Yeah, at this point, they've came up together, but she has surpassed him in the ranks.
Oh, that was very interesting because there was a remark from Bach that said, right. "Like, did you guys break up because you became a colonel and he was just a major, and like he was like a male chauvinist pig kind of person?"
Yeah,
and he couldn't deal with it.
And she doesn't deny it. She just says that was just the start of it. So it wasn't that there was more to it than that, but that seems to have definitely been a part of it, that he had a problem with her being promoted ahead of him or something.
Right.
If not for the fact that she was a woman, you know, but it may have been that, or just the fact that they were in a relationship and he needed to be the superior one or whatever. But anyway, so Duke and Buck are pretty similar type of alpha male guys, and so they just immediately start jostling for dominance.
Yeah, during a training session with all the other people, Buck is in front of the guys, and he's saying, "Oh, this is how you should fly, you know, use an attack pattern like you're going after a quarterback." He's like talking about like blitzing the quarterback. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting analogy, but then Duke isn't making wisecracks, and then all the cadets are like, you know, assembling around Duke and making fun of him. And
yeah,
then
they've never heard of football, so all the words that he's using are like, they're cracking up. Even at the word football, they're like, "You put a ball on your foot? What is that?"
And then Buck decides to do a live demonstration. He's like, "Dude, could you stand up over there? I want to show you what it's like when you sack a quarterback."
Yeah.
And then it just gets ridiculous. Like, they just keep hitting each other until the class is dismissed.
And they slam each other. Every time they slam each other, it's into something that's, I think they place stuff all around the room, like shelving and stuff like that, purposely, so it was there for them to tackle each other into. But the first time that Duke does it to Buck, he's like, "Did I do that right?" And he hit him from behind, so Buck says, "No, that was actually clipping. Let me show you how to do it the right way." And so he tackles him again and stuff, and there's only, there's only one cadet really that I guess they paid to have a speaking role, but she just keeps, it's this woman that's sitting there, and she keeps repeating like any football terminology that Buck says, like incredulously, and just, you know, like quarterback, and then just looks around and laughs with everybody else.
Yeah, it was a good alpha male scene.
And actually, I think it was before this, but I wrote down this quote that Buck had because I thought I had to do a double take because I thought he swore. Because he says something's wrong with your funkin' Wagnalls, and so it took me a second to recognize what he said, but that was a funny reference because Funkin' Wagnalls was an encyclopedia, and it was actually the encyclopedia set that we had when I was a kid. You know, it was. The 80s, so it was still pre having computers around and stuff like that to look stuff up. It was still early enough that, you know, that you still, one of the things you want in your house is an encyclopedia set, especially if you have kids for school and stuff.
Yeah.
And that was the set that we had, was a Funkin' Wagnalls set.
That's where all our research used to come out of, was encyclopedia, except mine was Britannica.
Yeah.
I never heard the other set.
I think it was like a cheaper version or something, maybe. But so I thought it was a funny reference.
Did he say effin'?
Yeah, I thought I said something's wrong with your fucking wagons or something. I'm like, wait a second, this is not. You can't say the F word in this show.
But, so at this time, Earth is getting like these food pellets or chips, and they're getting shipped from another planet, and it's causing illness amongst all of the people. But what it's really breaking down is a lot of the pilots. So their defense system is really bad because they're losing pilots left and right. And one of the doctors, Dr. Mallory, he actually discovers it is the pallets with his computer. And I can't remember his computer's name. Do you remember?
You know, I can't remember the name of it. I just wrote down that it's a total smartass.
Yeah, it's a smartass like mainframe computer with reel-to-reel things hanging off of it. It actually looks, for it being the brains, it actually looks much less sophisticated than Dr. Theopolis. You know what I mean? It seems like Theopolis could crunch on that shit a lot faster, plus he's got smaller chips.
Yeah, which it's totally similar in the sense that it has its own personality and everything, so it's a it's like an artificial intelligence, so they got that concept, you know, in terms of their futurism in the show, but they didn't imagine that it would be, you know, super small or anything like that. But yeah, he has this total sarcastic relationship with Dr. Mallory, but it's you could tell, especially later, that Dr. Mallory definitely has a definitely cares about the computer, you know. It's like one of those things, like
he cares, but he also depends. It was almost like a scary dependency, because it reminded me a lot of like Magnus Robot Fighter in the future, when robots start to do everything, you know what I mean, and he just sits there and works with this machine, but it seems like without that machine he's lost his better half. Like he just can't function anymore.
Mm-hmm. Actually, was the computer's name Carl?
Yeah, it was Carl.
Yeah, okay, because I have poor Carl written down here. I'm trying to remember what that referred to, but I think, yeah, so Carl gets taken out because Mallory's assistant, this blonde woman, she turns out to be a plant from the enemy, and when Mallory is gone, she puts her iPhone on this like little device on Carl, and it causes his circuits to fry and him to burn out. But so I think, I don't know if this is when I think we get to meet Jack Palance at this point, his character. He's kind of like a cult leader, sort of.
Yeah. It was a very upsetting scene, because you see the betrayal of... He's a cult leader, and there's a husband and wife, and you see a wife betray the husband, saying, "Khalil, he doesn't believe in you anymore." It's
like, yeah, she says that he speaks against Khalil in his sleep.
Yeah.
So she totally rats him out. As you mentioned, Khalil's power, he has this, he calls it the touch of truth, and his hands glow red, and it looks like he's been outside for way too long and he needs some like moisturizer cream on his hands. But you know, so he walks up and it's a whole like witch trial kind of logic, where he says, you know, if it's, you know, if he's innocent, you know, my touch will not kill him. But you get the sense that there's really no chance of him not killing this person with his touch, that's going to happen regardless of what he says. And Khalil's also got a number of different lackeys that work for him. And one thing I thought funny throughout was, I don't know if it's just the actors took cue from Jack Palance's performance, but they're like, I've rarely seen villains enjoy themselves as much as Khalil and his people. and his people really, really enjoy him too. Like, they're just, when he's describing his plot and bad things that he's going to do to Earth, his people are always just grinning ear to ear and looking at him with adoration. I mean, I guess in that sense, it's pretty good acting, because, you know, you get the sense that these people are just really, they're really fascinated with Khalil, and at no point do you question that his, you know, his few people, like the, you know, the woman that was the traitor on Earth and destroyed Carl, and then he's got
one working for the governor. The governor of the planet,
mm-hmm.
Roddy McDowell's character, and he's oblivious to it. He has no clue.
Yeah.
And then he's got another pilot that used to be a pilot on Earth that is now more like a mercenary that works for Khalil. So he's mm-hmm. like a well-known pilot that Aaron Gray recognizes later on.
Yeah, and so... So the planet itself is ruled by this governor who, his son is one of a few that aren't happy with Khalil and think that their whole system that they have set up of using these slave women is unfair. But I think before we get to that point, there's a sequence where... Wilma and Dr. Heuer go in to respond to the fact that Carl has been destroyed, and Buck's with them. And I guess it's some sort of thing that Buck hasn't completely accepted the terms that would make him a full citizen or something like that. He hasn't accepted some sort of terms, so he's not allowed to be privy to their conversation.
Oh my God, that was fucking hilarious.
So
I don't know. I actually thought that was the most ridiculous scene ever. It's almost like you say, "Oh, we can't talk about this in front of you because you haven't signed this, become a citizen." So right. Go over there and we'll talk about this classified information, in which he can hear every fucking word they say. God dang.
Right. Yeah, he just takes a few steps away and turns his back. It's ridiculous. He's just listening in, so then of course comments on what they're saying, and just says, "Okay, fine, like, you know, I'll accept the terms to make myself a full citizen," or whatever it is. And then
I'd say, "Fuck the terms, I could hear everything anyway. Yeah. I don't need to know. I can just sit here right, 10 feet away and hear everything that you say."
Yeah. But
they didn't even try to like whisper.
No. Dr. Hero just says, "Oh, okay, great. I'm glad to hear it, Buck. What's your comment?"
That was the funniest part, I thought.
Yeah, that was pretty ridiculous. But so as a result, though, of this conversation, they do end up going to Khalil's planet. But first, there's an attack on their lives by Boomerang, the Flash villain.
That's right.
This assassin uses this high-powered electrified boomerang to try to assassinate. I don't know if he's after all three of them, but he's definitely after one of them.
I think he was going after you.
Yeah, this like garden area. But Buck's successful in saving the other two, and so they end up heading to the planet to try to figure out what's going on.
And he gets to travel also with his new buddy Duke, which they still don't get along very well.
So Duke and then another one of his pilots, a woman.
That female that was making all the wisecracks, right? I thought it was the same one.
Yeah. Yeah, she had a fairly kind of a small role, but it was a speaking role.
And also the son of Roddy McDowell. He was going back to.
Right, yeah, because he was actually... Was he the one that initially got sick at the beginning?
Yeah, he was the one that got sick at the beginning, but right. He wasn't the first. In other words, that they had known about it. They were just keeping it quiet. It sounded like because they didn't want to start a panic, but yet they're feeding him more pellets. They're not saying don't eat this. I don't think they had an alternative, to tell you the truth, because only Buck knows how to hunt.
Those yeah, it didn't sound like it. It didn't sound like it because, you know, just jumping forward briefly later on when Duke and Buck are stuck in the desert together, Buck hunts and kills something, and Duke is part of our vegetable alliance. He's used to eating pills instead of real meat. He's disgusted by the meat. He won't eat it.
Yeah, all the soy he eats that's flavored like meat.
Yeah, so he's used to his beet burgers and everything, and he doesn't want Buck's food. But which, for the record, I actually don't like beet burgers because I don't like beets.
Ah, you could tell Bomer that.
Yeah, because Bill was talking about eating it, and then Daryl picked up on that. And I was wondering why Daryl was asking me if I was eating beet burgers.
Yeah, Daryl gets angry. He actually hears that talk, and he just gets angry. He'll always text me. He's like, they're talking about eating grass again.
That's awesome. So they're on the planet, and I thought it was pretty awesome that, Rima comes in at this point because she is the one that serves at the table where Buck and Wilma and Duke and Hewer and all them are having, having a meal with the governor and his son. And she makes a mistake, and the governor is immediately on her shit, like, you know, this is a privilege to work here in the dining hall, and I think you're not capable of it, so you're probably going to have to go, you know, work in the mines again or something like that. Like, she's going to be demoted just for making a brief mistake. And Buck's like, yo, like, chill out, dude. Like, it's not a big deal. It's fine. And, you know, no, this is unacceptable. And Buck just keeps telling him, like, it's fine. It's fine. It's not a big deal. And so later on, Buck's bathing in this humongous bathtub in his quarters, like, that he's staying in at this place, and he's singing Strangers in the Night, exchanging glances. And Rima sneaks into the room and switches his radio to sexy music. So I thought something was going to happen here, and actually that was kind of what was supposed to happen, was that she was supposed to, you know, offer herself to him. But she turns on this music and cranks it up as a cover for no one hearing what they're talking about, because there's a guard stationed outside. And she thanks him for what he, you know, for defending her earlier, and at this point recruits Buck to help out with what's going on. Like, she starts to let him in on what's really going on the planet, and how there's this guy that has everybody under his thumb.
And then you get a weird scene where he, like, crawls into the wall, and he has, like, a black outfit, and he goes and is doing some undercover work.
Yeah.
And there's a scene there, and I have to, like, double take, where there's a fight scene where he's fighting, and I swear to you, that is not Gil Gerard fighting. That is some...
I noticed that too.
Stunt,
yeah.
That is some stuntman that looks nothing, not even close in build. He's a lot thinner. Mm-hmm. He doesn't even have the same build structure, and he does all the fighting. And then, then when it goes to the close up, there's Gil Gerard.
Yeah, I definitely noticed that too. It they didn't really pull that off very well. I can say for sure.
That was worse than later on when they're fighting in the gold suits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, definitely it wasn't as noticeable stunt double use or anything like that. But that was not a good casting of a stunt double there. Wasn't enough of, like, because it's shot from far away, so, you know, because as you might normally do, because he doesn't have a, like, his head's face isn't obstructed at all, so the guy's got a similar haircut and everything like that, but yeah, they didn't find somebody that has a similar enough build. And
because he was a lot lankier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so it made you look even closer at it and notice that he didn't really look like him either. But the reason that he's doing this, though, is because at first he's just going to leave out the front, you know, out of the door. But Rama says that, you know, if he leaves without her, then they'll know something's up, you know, because she's supposed to be in there having some private time with him. So that's why he does the whole, okay, I'll climb out the window thing.
Yeah, the sexy time.
Yeah.
Buck gets out of the sexy time. He's not ready for it yet.
No.
I think he needs his parts to unfreeze and still, because I swear, if I was dreaming about sexy women, like, on the spaceship for 500 years, I would be like, first thing I'd want to do.
Yeah. And he is happy to go along with the, you know, the deception of the guard, because he says, you know, he has a reputation to uphold of his own.
Yeah.
Being a man of action, as it were.
And isn't it that around that time where they're taking the girl, I guess they're going to take the girl back to the planet because they uncover something, and then Wilma tries to rescue her, and then she gets captured.
Yeah, because it doesn't work out. Rama is found alone in Buck's room, and she tries to make something up, but they're like, and why exactly did he leave out the window?
Yeah.
It doesn't work. So, yeah, so she's taken in. And, yeah, Wilma comes, like, as you said. And so, ultimately, what happens is that both Wilma and Rima are captured. And Rima is, or Wilma's changed into slave outfit because she's going to be put into slavery as well.
Right. And they still manage to leave the tracking device on her. So when they search her and take stuff off, she still has her little wristwatch that I guess tells Buck, like, you know, her heartbeat and her vitals, and, you know, she's still around. Plus it's like a GPS where he could actually see how far away she is.
Yeah. And I guess the explanation for that is they don't really, it's not a technology they recognize or understand what it is. They might think that it's jewelry or whatever, and that's acceptable for, I guess, for the, you know, they need it for plot reasons. But yeah, I don't think we mentioned that before they went to this planet. Tiggy actually stayed up all night and made them for them.
He's actually a hell of a, like, a mechanic or whatever you want to say, you know, like computer technician and everything, mm-hmm. like all around guy. Theopolis obviously is the brains, but Twiggy is actually the guy who, you know, does the work.
Yeah.
And Theopolis just sits there and gets all the credit.
Yeah. Yeah. So I have, on my notes, I have sort of a missing spot here in the sequence of, how we get to the point where Buck and Duke are stuck in the desert together.
Oh yeah, they have that tracking device, so they basically take two fighters. One fighter is for that other pilot that I don't think they ever mentioned her name. She's to go back to Earth and get an army ready, or just alert them on what's going on. Duke and Buck are going to find Wilma. And Duke is flying the plane, and they basically have isn't it a device that takes out the electronics on the thing, and they end up crashing in the desert?
Yeah, that sounds right.
There's like some kind of device that they're able to hit it with that depowers it, and they lose flight capability, and they crash into the desert. And then, so they crash in, and then there's these weird, like, sunburnt, dried skin guys covered all in black that are just in the back scenes, kind of like following on them in the meantime. But Buck and them, they land safely, and they pull out these gold like jackets. And they're the ugliest things ever, but they cover their entire body except for their face. And they put these things on so they don't get sun damage, and then they pretty much trek out. And it's I can't remember how many kilometers was it, but it was like 20 kilometers away that they could see Wilma's device. So they go on this walk while these guys in black are essentially like nomads. They're following them, and then they start to – they actually have a good conversation. They sit and eat. And this is when, like, the bonding started. Buck hunts down these little, I guess they're like frog-looking things. They look like small little chickens. And he starts eating them. You know, he cooks them, and then he gives one to Duke. And Duke is like, you're primitive. I ain't going to eat this shit. So, you know, Buck's enjoying his meal. Buck just says, well, eat that stuff and take your chance of getting sick. And so I guess Duke just decides not to eat, but... These guys want to raid whatever they have in their backpack and I guess whatever food they have. So they have these slingshot weapons. They're very unusual. They put these like bomb contraptions inside of the sling, and then they sling it at them, and then it like blows up. But they're not too effective with them because it blows up near them, but they manage to survive that. And that's when they do this like tag team fight scene. And here's where the bonding begins. Like, they start to trust one another. They start to work together, and you know, everything starts to be copacetic between the two of them.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just have to comment on those outfits that they wear. They're like hooded gold 80s jumpsuits. They look like they should be, you know, in the background of some, like early Paula Abdul video or something,
or like in a
pretty awesome
Austin Powers movie or something.
Yeah. And yeah, and it's weird because when Buck's trying to get Duke to eat whatever meat that he killed and stuff, he actually says that the guys on DC Noise don't have any problem eating this kind of thing. So I thought that was a
that exhaust surprise. Reference.
That was a surprising reference, yeah.
Well, that's because he's in the future. He used to listen to DC Noise back in the day.
Yeah, in his cockpit.
While he was asleep.
Yeah. Yeah, good thing his dreams were about you know, he didn't have dreams of, like, you guys laying around in bikinis or anything like that.
thank God. That would have been one hell of a scene, opening scene.
Yeah, I would have canceled this project. But
we ain't watching that.
Like, this is terrible. What is this? but yeah, it is cool. It's, I mean, you've seen it before, but... And Wilma comments at one point when they're on the way to the planet, she tells Buck, you know, you have to give Duke a chance. You guys are way too alike, and that's the problem. And they really start to bond and have some mutual respect for each other, for the way that they can both take care of business. You know, after that fight, you know, they're mutually complimentary of their fighting skills. And they sort of, given the common goal, they both care about Wilma and they both want to rescue her, so they have that common goal to work on together. And I liked watching the two of them become friends.
Yeah, and they come close to the site, and then they realize that this is a bigger plot than they imagined, because they find, like, at least, I don't know, it was like 30 ships. Like attack ships. And when they see those attack ships, they're like, well, shit, one of us has to take one of those ships and fly back to Earth and get our military ready, because they're obviously going to attack us, because they know that most of our pilots are poisoned. So Duke takes one of those old fighters or one of those fighters and goes back while Buck tries to get into the mountain in which Wilma's there.
Mm-hmm.
But the evil people have discovered Wilma's transmitter, and the villain, which is Stella, she's the one that was working for Dr. Malloroy. She notifies Khalil of this, and then puts the transmitter on him, and they like capture Buck almost immediately as soon as he enters the mountain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the place that they have Wilma and Rima trapped, apparently wherever these dungeons are, it's really, really hot in there.
Yeah, it's like a sauna.
Yeah.
It's like where Chuck from Star Joe's goes to get like a, what is it called? The Schwitz?
Schwitz, yeah, I think.
It's like where he gets naked and goes in one of those sweat rooms.
Yeah.
So what Wilma and the slave girl were in.
Right. Except for this is one that actually seems appealing to me.
Yeah.
Like, I would show up for this one.
Instead of seeing like 60-year-old naked men.
Right. I had to do internet research very carefully, but I had to do internet research just to believe Chuck's stories.
And Chuck is a friend of ours from the Star Joe's podcast.
Yeah.
So you should check that out.
Definitely. And they actually cover a lot of, even though a lot of the stuff they cover came out recently, most of it's based on 80s properties, so it's a good crossover from this show.
Yeah.
So Buck ends up rescuing, I don't remember how he gets free, but he rescues Wilma and Rima.
Oh, he's thrown into the sweat pit with them.
Okay.
And this is what's interesting. He managed to smuggle in into the sauna looking room, which it looks like the bottom of a volcano kind of thing where things are just bubbling and stuff.
Yeah.
But there's like pipes and there's vents at the top of it. And it's just like pumping in a lot of heat and water to keep the humidity, I guess, really high. So you eventually die. But, he manages to smuggle in one of those bombs that he stole from the nomads that were the slingshot. And he tells Wilma, he's like, I'm going to go over here and I'm going to put this under a rock and it's going to launch me into the vents. So he like plants this bomb and it launches him up to the pipe, and then he like crawls on the pipe all the way out to the vent. And then he goes into, I guess on the other side is a storage area where he has a rope. And he basically throws down the rope and then has like Rima climb over him, like just, and then Wilma's obviously next, but he has them escape. That's how they escape.
And, I mean, there really isn't enough room in that pipe for anything but them to have to be pulled up and then like drag their bodies over top of his. I don't think he was complaining either.
Yeah, it wasn't like Duke was on top of him. So.
Yeah.
He was like, yeah, it's two sexy women rubbing all over him. That's got to be a good experience.
This will work out. This will compensate for having to wear that stupid jumpsuit. So, I don't know if I'm skipping anything here. I just watched this yesterday. I don't know what's wrong with my brain. But, eventually, so Duke ends up heading back to Earth, and this is where he has to recruit a ragtag group, including, like you said, the original actor, Buck Rogers, who plays Duke's former instructor, who Duke's real happy to see, and he's, you know, happy to step back into service to help out. It's really kind of cool role for him, as you know, as the actor. It was a cool way to bring him into the series. And so they take this small force and are planning to head back to attack the planet. And they're going to try to use maneuvers, even though they have smaller numbers or try to just use strategy to overcome Khalil's forces stuff. But meanwhile, we find out that there's a defector in the ranks commanding the forces over at this other planet. So their hopes of having, you know, the Earth forces, their hopes of having a strategic advantage over the enemy is probably not going to come to fruition. It's someone that, as you said earlier, Wilma recognizes. I forget his name, but he basically left Earth services at one point and
I think it was Galen.
Yeah, maybe. Sounds right. But he put his services out there to the highest bidder, basically became a mercenary. And so he's going to command the forces, and he has, you know, the strategic abilities to combat. So it doesn't look like Earth is has a very good chance. But Wilma and Buck managed to get control of two of the fighters in their forces.
And there's an interesting scene when they do get in space because Duke doesn't believe it's Buck.
Right.
So he has to convince him it really is him.
Yeah. So it's a callback to Duke explaining about football earlier, and Duke asks, who's the juice?
the O.J. Simpson reference. That's yeah. Right. I forgot about that.
Yeah, so that was their way of convincing Duke that it was really Buck and Wilma, was that Buck knew that the juice was O.J. Simpson. And I mean, it is a good, you know, that's not something that, well, it's kind of funny, you know, like at the time they thought O.J. Simpson, the only thing that he would be remembered for was being a football player.
Great running back for the Buffalo yeah. Bills, and maybe the Naked Gun. No, that was after this.
Yeah. So, but yeah, so that was their code language, and that's how Duke is convinced. And so, you know, also a neat callback to earlier, you know, because Buck and Duke have become friends by this point, Duke's willing to actually listen to Buck's strategic advice and is willing to hand over command to Buck because they end up using some of these football tactics that they had looked at earlier to essentially, you know, use a few planes to engage, you know, the bulk of the fighters, the offensive line, essentially, and then send in a few planes after the commander of the forces. As Buck knows, you know, he's the only one that has any sort of strategic mind, so if they take him out, the rest of the group will scatter.
And Twiggy's also flying.
Yeah.
but they use that good strategy to, like, blitz the quarterback, so they have mm-hmm. their defensive line open up, like, or engage the offensive line, and then the linebackers blitz up the middle, and then it leaves like a safety blitz for Buck to just go up the middle and hit the quarterback. And that's their strategy. And then on the planet, Rima is there, and she's captured again and brought forth to Jack Palance's Khalil there, and he's going to kill her with his magic red hands. And during this time, he's like, she's not like showing any fear. Like, she's mm-hmm. like, bring it on, you jerk. You know, like, what are you going to do? Kill me already. And she has like no fear whatsoever. She's ready to accept her death. And Jack Palance is like trying to hide it, but he's like, oh shit, my power's not working. So yeah. it like works off of the fear of the people. And when somebody doesn't have any fear, it's like nothing is going to happen with his red hand. So he's like, you know, just take her away and kill her, that kind of thing.
Yeah, she's very defiant.
Yeah.
And she's a Brienne Leary, she's a good actress. I mean, a lot of the roles, the guest stars in this episode were good. You know, David Groh as Duke Danton, I thought, you know, he pulled off his role as well. And yeah, she's very defiant, says, you know, I'm not going to give you the satisfaction of my fear. She doesn't know that's going to save her life, but she's just not going to go down whimpering. She's going to go down defiantly. And as you said, I mean, that ends up saving her life. And, you know, we do get another, I don't know if this is the right sequencing, but we get another a scene with the governor and his son, where, you know, the governor, his eyes have finally been opened that he's been used as a lackey all this time, you know, as a figurehead, and he's finally sort of doubting the lifestyle that he's been enjoying on the back of all these slaves, and finally willing to listen to his son, but he has a lot of self-doubt as to whether he knows the truth about anything really at this point.
He's willing to give up his position and resign, essentially.
Yeah.
And then they don't think that's necessary, but Buck mentions he should go back with his son and his son should go with him. And his son says, sure, I will go with you. And I guess at this point, Rima is like his woman. And she goes back with him as well. And this is after they've already captured Khalil. Like, because later on, the slaves, you know, overcome the people there. And then there's a scene there with Buck and them going after Khalil. And then he tries to use his red hands again and nothing works. And they just pretty much carry him off to be imprisoned, I guess.
Yeah. And then there's a happy ending where they're going to have a threesome.
Yeah, it's a menage a trois.
Because Buck comes out and Duke and Wilma are walking along the hallway and he's like, where are you guys going? You know, or what are your plans later? And Wilma says, I'm going out with Duke. Or, you know, we got, and Buck's kind of surprised. He's like, oh, I thought I, you know, had the upper hand here with her. And Duke says, and you're coming along with us. And then the three of them, you know, walk towards the camera and it fades to black. And things happen that aren't appropriate for a children's show or a family show.
It's one of those typical endings to either a sitcom or a drama at that time. One of those happy things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess a more innocent time, but watching it today, it's like, it really does kind of, it's like, you know, when they invite Duke along, it does seem like they're like.
Well, actually, they invite Buck along.
Or that's what I meant to say. Yeah. Yeah.
It sure does look like that. Mm-hmm. But I still don't think Buck at this time wants to pull out his wiener.
Yeah, he's lacking confidence.
Yeah, he just doesn't know how to use it, 25th century.
Yeah. So, but that's that kind of wraps things up. And yeah, it was, I don't know if it was, I mean, I may have liked the first story a little bit better, but it definitely was another good one.
Yeah, I think the first, I sure love when the ships leave the thing and it goes, the sound the special effects make, you know, when they like leave, that's awesome. I just love that. I love the ship designs too, yeah. I really wish I could make that. It sounds so much better.
Yeah, but it does have some good sound design.
I watched
it's pretty good so far.
I watched it with Barb she was watching it kind of through the corner of her eye, and she's the one that pointed out that the old guy was, you know, the original Buck Rogers. And I thought that's when I went down that tangent and looked it up.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, she's the one that pointed out she was looking at all the actors in it, because it was interesting for both of us, I guess, to see all these people in it.
Mm-hmm. Does she have any memories of the show back in the day?
Yeah, she watched it. I don't think she's as fond of it as I am, but.
Right.
She was a TV junkie, man. She could do a TV podcast. She was, I don't know if you ever saw that HBO show Dream On or whatever, where his whole reality was based on him watching TV as a kid. Like his mom and dad would just leave and say, "Here's the TV," and he's in front of the TV. He grew up as a TV addict. That's Barb. She knows her 70s and 80s TV like nobody's business.
Yeah, I used to sneak downstairs and watch Dream On after my parents went to bed. Because it's an HBO show, so obviously.
Yeah, there was some nudity in that one.
Yeah. But yeah, I haven't thought about that show in a while, but that was a good show because they would show how his brain was always referencing TV he saw when he was a kid. Because something would happen in the show and all of a sudden it would jump to a clip from an old TV show to show what was going through his brain.
Even in college, Barb wouldn't miss her programs. I'm like, "You got a test tomorrow. Where aren't you going to study?" It's like, after my program. It's like, I didn't watch any TV when I was in school, except for when I was in college, except for like maybe on the weekend I'd watch one.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'd watch the Lobo game, which is, you know, the mascot for New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd watch the basketball games, but on the weekends, and that was pretty much it.
Mm.
Unless there was a superhero show, then I'd record it and watch it on Saturday at night or Sunday.
I didn't watch a lot of TV in college either, but not because I was a good student or anything, just because, you know, we didn't have cable and I was just too busy doing other stuff.
I studied a lot, man. I really did. And then I worked two jobs, so it was the rough.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
I don't have that adrenaline. I don't know how I did it. Like, I look back at that, and I was like, that was the hardest working time of my life ever.
Well, that's probably the time to do it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's good that you had already met Barb then, because you probably wouldn't have had time to meet any other women.
Yeah, that's true.
That worked out good.
Yeah, I had met her before, so.
Right.
In high school, so I already knew. But, yeah, that was a good episode. I agree with you, though. It wasn't as good as the first one. And you can tell probably the budget for the first one was a little bit higher.
Yeah.
Then this one. This one's probably going more into TV mode.
Mm-hmm.
But it was still really, really, really good. And, like, the fact that they did put Buster Crabtree in there, and while they were going to attack the other ships, there was like a discussion between Buck and him, and they were like throwing back your Easter eggs. Like, like he was Buck Rogers before. He's like, "I've been doing this before your time, son."
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, I like that character. The old, you know, the old veteran that comes back into service. It's cool.
Yeah.
I like those kind of characters. So, yeah, I don't know. Unless you know off the top of your head, I'll look it up. But I'm not sure if we got another two-parter coming up or.
Oh, no, it's a single one and then followed by a two-parter.
Okay. So I guess it kind of makes sense to just do the single episode for next time then.
Yeah, Vegas in Space.
Ah. Sounds promising.
Yeah, it does. It should be interesting, and it features Cesar Romero, so isn't that the joke? The 66 Batman?
Mm-hmm.
So it should be interesting.
Nice.
So we got some comics. What do you got this week?
Yes. Comic books. Well, you know, I never read Millennium, the DC crossover.
Uh-huh.
And even though I've read some other books around it, like tie-ins and stuff that I just happened to come up to in a run of a book. So I'll, you know, read that issue. But this was, I guess, probably the third one. I think, like, you had Crisis and then you had Legends. I'd read both of those.
I think Millennium was before Legends, wasn't it?
No, definitely. It was definitely after.
It seemed like... I know I enjoyed Legends a hell of a lot more. Mm-hmm. Because that was like, you know, Suicide Squad introduced and Justice right. League, the Bwahaha years, and a lot of other stuff. Plus, yeah, it had Godfrey. It had some. It had the link to the Dark Side and all that shit.
Yeah. Because, yeah. So as you said, the Justice League came out of Legends and the first week of crossovers. It's still really early, but it's the first week of crossovers includes Justice League International number 9. But yeah, it's interesting how at this point they've really got the whole crossover machine rolling. You know, the last page of issue 1 has an advertisement for the book itself, and it says over 30 official crossovers, which nowadays, like, I don't think that they would put that out there as a positive thing. Like, they might
not wanna, with a $3.99 or $2.99 cover price.
Yeah, they would want to maybe keep that on the down low, like how many crossovers. But yeah, there was like 5 or 6 a week. It was an 8-week event, so Millennium was put out weekly from October 6th through November 24th of 87, I think. And each week, you know, was labeled as such on the crossovers. So I won't list all of them, but the first week had Firestorm 67, Flash 8, Justice League International 9, Outsiders 27, and Wonder Woman 12. And the way the issue ends is actually directly, it ends with something directly tying into each one of those issues. You know, you see the protagonists of all those books heading off and running into a character.
It's basically their loved ones or somebody they know is a manhunter.
So someone, is close to them. But yeah, so that's the whole deal. Like, I just read issue 1, and it's written by Steve Englehart with layouts by Joe Staton and Ian Gibbon finishes. And it starts with a secret meeting of manhunters. You know, these, as you said, these people that we know around the DC universe, meeting together in this beach, on Manhattan Beach, actually. There's like Mr. Smith from Ferris Aircraft, Lana Lang, a bunch of different people that are named, and it's kind of a rally. And who of all people is watching from a rooftop nearby, but Tom Kalamaku from Green Lantern, longtime side character from the Green Lantern books that worked at Ferris Aircraft, and he's an adult now with family, and he's planning on
just a real quick thing about him. Back in the day, they used to do a racial term on him. They used to call him Pie Face.
I know, and they actually even make a reference of it in here.
I was like, damn. I'm a Green Lantern fan. I read a lot of them, and even when I read that, I'm like, they're calling him Pie Face?
Yeah, and I don't think even at this point they realized that they were, because there says, Tom Kalamaku thinks of his wife and kids. Tom Kalamaku remembers why his friends used to call him Pie Face. And I was trying to, like, I don't...
Maybe he ate pie and I never caught it, but I thought it was a racial mark.
Yeah. Yeah. At least from the tone of this, it seems like they, if it is, then they're not understanding it. But anyway, I mean, he's representative positively. Like, he wants to, his plan is to go contact Hal Jordan and tell him what's going on, but he's discovered by three manhunters, and, you know, they start beating him mercilessly. He's just sort of left there to see at this point. You know, we're not sure what his fate's going to be, but until we switch over to the Green Lantern Corps Citadel in Santa Monica Mountains. And, you know, at this point, the Green Lantern Corps has kind of become independent of the Guardians, but Hal is still around as a Lantern. And, you know, so, like, this is prior to him, like, becoming a Spectre and stuff and all that business. But it's him and Kilowog and John Stewart, Katmatui and Arisia. They're having a pool party. When all of a sudden a Guardian and a Zamaron show up, and they're drawing that, like, the Zamaron here doesn't look as alien as they did like in the Jeff Johns run and stuff. She looks just kind of like a woman, like a normal human woman with long curly hair, you know, with their, like, battle outfit that they wear.
Yeah, it's almost like Amazon armor.
Yeah. So they show up, and, like, the Lanterns all suit up, and the Guardian, who introduces himself as Harupa Hando Hu, tells them about the danger approaching of the Manhunters and stuff. So the Manhunters, it turns out they don't actually kill Tom Kalamaku. But both of his legs are broken. The reason they don't kill him, because they think that people just think that he's a drunk, and so he's left to crawl his way across this airport tarmac, and a plane actually goes up overhead, and sort of the concussion of it. Take off, knocks him out. Now, I was kind of surprised to see Harbinger appear then. There's this page featuring her and how, you know, there's a little bit of a flashback to how she was, like, what she did in the Crisis event and everything like that, and then how she's taken a record of everything, made a permanent archive of this new world that's been created by the Crisis, and then she launched it into orbit as a masterwork dedicated to the Monitor, and then she's kind of like, now what do I do? But we leave her there, and then we have this grand gathering of superheroes of the time. So it's very much of a snapshot into the 80s, what's going on, because of the warning given to the Green Lantern Corps, they call in all these other superheroes. So we have Justice League International show up, and Justice League has just become international at this point. The series had just switched over after, like, six issues of just being the Justice League, and Captain Atom and Rocket Red have just been added to the team as a part of their, like, international status. Dr. Fate, as a result, also really not has just recently left the team, but he shows up as well. And then the Outsiders come in, Batman's other team. So they pop up, and then Infinity Inc. shows up, which there's a neat little panel where this turns out actually to be the first meeting of Jade and Green Lantern. Or Hal Jordan, that is. She says, yeah, we'll have to talk about Alan Scott sometime. So there's a pretty cool splash page where you have all these heroes gathered together. You know, in addition to the teams that I've already mentioned, the Hawks are there, Superman's there, Green Arrow, Firestorm, and the Guardian and the Zamaron. You know, they fill in all the heroes on what's going on. They talk about how, you know, their history as a race and how, you know, they being immortal, the Zamarons and the Guardians separated from each other and took different evolutionary paths and how they achieved their goals and stuff. And but because of the crisis, there's only 22 Guardians left. So they decided to pair together with the Zamarons, and they said, the crisis reduced the Guardians to a total of 22. Harupa and I chose to discover if the state between male and female could be renewed. If it could. And so 22 pairs of us left the universe to do it. The panel where it says to do it, it has a Guardian with a big Amazonian. Yeah. Practically. He's like lounging backwards, and there's like this big Amazonian woman that's twice his size, like leaning on his shoulder, like all sexy. Like, it's just like such a strange pairing. Like, yeah. It's like, you're like, that Guardian must have like a lot of cash or something. Like, it's like seeing like one of those, like, you know, guys that are in their 80s that have like a playmate wife or something, because they're like worth,
yeah, it's 12, like you
have trillion to. Dollars, yeah, little, they're little blue Hugh Hefners. So Superman's like, well, I'm following you, but what does this have to do with all of us? And so the Guardian tells that they're going to choose 10 people from the planet to propel towards the future, but to do that, they need to protect these people, you know, that these, they tell them how they created the Manhunters and how they, you know, how that backfired and how they've gone off on their own, how they created the Green Lantern Corps and all this history, all this exposition and stuff, how the Manhunters want to presume, you know, how the heroes need to protect. Need to protect these 10 people because the Manhunter is going to be after them. And there's it's kind of funny, Scott Free, Mr. Miracle's there because he's a part of JLI at the time, as well as Oberon. And they wonder why Earth was chosen, why, you know, there wasn't a more evolved world that they chose, like New Genesis. So I thought that was amusing since we just read all of that. But and it was also, it's also kind of interesting that so Wally West asks where the Teen Titans are in all this plan, and this is when the Zamaron says that they're actually planning on, they've actually chosen one of the Teen Titans as one of the 10, and that they're talking about Terra. And Geo-Force is there as one of the outsiders and says, you do know my sister's dead, right? It's actually not how he says it, but the Guardian is actually surprised. They're not aware of the fact that Terra has died, and you know, they've developed this whole plan from far removed from the Earth universe, and they're not up to date on who's even alive. So Superman has kind of a big speech. It's like sort of a, like at this time, like Superman's very much like the figurehead of all the superheroes, you know. He's the leader, and he's got very much that role. Like they use him like that a lot early on in Justice League. You know, he's not a part of the team, but he's a part of
the morale speaker.
Yeah, like he shows up at the UN and is part of convincing them to even have an internationally sponsored Justice League team. And he just has this very huge influential presence. And he gives this big speech about, regardless of the circumstances here, like we're the protectors of Earth. So if the Manhunters are a danger to Earth, regardless of whatever like the Guardians have planned and these 10 people and stuff, like it's our job to protect them regardless, essentially. And you know, pretty much everyone's like, yep, you pretty much said it there, Superman. No one can argue with that. So all the teams disperse, and as I mentioned earlier, this is where we get five short sequences that tie into the crossovers that week, where the Justice League, the ones that can't fly, are on board the Beatles bug, and Rocket Red says, "Excuse me, Leaguers, I would speak with you. It is time that I reveal my secret to you." You know, and the Firestorm goes home, or goes back to the lab, and there's the guy Ferguson there, and the Outsiders return, and there's Dr. Jace. Wally goes home, and his dad confronts him, and then Wonder Woman goes, and the god Pan speaks with her, and they're all like, "I gotta tell you something, you know, and you better not help the Guardians create their 10 people, or we're going to destroy you. So no one escapes the Manhunters."
Yeah, that's their shtick.
Yeah, I mean, if you had any wondered what, you know, Rocket Red was going to tell the Justice League, the fact that like the tie-in issue has him lifting one of the Leaguers over top of his head, screaming, "No one escapes the Manhunters," will tell you what how that one turns out. But yeah, I mean, I thought for an introduction to the series, it was pretty cool. Like it's definitely of like a time period in DC and comic books that I like. So it's cool to see all those heroes assembled and stuff.
I read it fairly recently, and I can't remember if issue one introduced a lot of the characters that become the new Guardians. Did it introduce that racist guy from South Africa?
No.
Okay, that must come later.
Mm.
And then there's a flamboyant one, a gay character. And I remember it very fondly because I remember all these characters they introduced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if it came out right now, I probably would avoid it because of all the crossovers and stuff, you know?
Yeah.
But now
you want to seek it out.
Yeah.
The one that I remember the most is Flash's father, I believe. Wally West's father is a Manhunter.
Yeah.
But there is one that I think they had to retrofit. I can't remember if it was Commissioner Gordon or it was like a big one.
Mm.
You know?
That they had to kind of go back.
Yeah, they had to go back on, yeah. But yeah, what did you think of Staton's art? Because it, you know, sometimes you see artists and it's like a Kirby thing. He has a very, very distinctive line. Mm-hmm. Like you can look at any Stat artwork that comes out in a comic, like E-Man or he did the Huntress a lot, you know, back in the day.
Yeah.
And his line is very distinctive. It'll like pop. It's a very different style of anatomy, or it's not like, what did you think of it? Did you like it or?
I do like the art, but I was going to say that, you know, because he's credited for layouts
mm-hmm.
only. And, I think that's why it looks a little bit different to me.
I don't know. It looks, if you look at the facial structure,
mm-hmm.
it's pretty much him.
Yeah.
The guy who's finishing is kind of inking over his line.
Yeah.
Because when you start going to cons, you like at least like Baltimore or Heroes or mm-hmm. you know, Joe's usually there and mm-hmm. you'll see him drawing and you can like look at all his work and you'll say Millennium. I mean, it'll pop mm-hmm. up at you like the style. It's very distinctive no matter who's inking him.
Mm.
It looks like his.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I would have to look at it side by side then with, like, he was doing some pencils on Green Lantern, like, in the early 80s.
Yeah.
That I read recently. And not that it's, like, totally different or anything like that.
It did look different to you.
Yeah, but it might just... Maybe if I pull out one of those issues and look at them side by side, it might just be my memory.
Yeah.
But regardless, I did like it though. I do like the style of the art. Because it's well done, pretty realistic and stuff.
Cool. So. Did you read that in trade or issue format?
I have the issues. At some point, I just bought the series in issue format, and just to have it, and taking me a while to pull it out.
Right.
Just like Buck Rogers.
Except that was like a while to pull out because you had to deal with the same disc being delivered to you.
Yeah. No, I mean just like it's.
Oh, like you pull Buck out.
Take Buck Rogers himself a while to pull out after.
Yeah.
Being frozen.
I don't even know if he gets lucky with Wilma until the second season. I can't remember.
Well, at least he's worth waiting for.
I just remember the vampire episode. That might be into the second season, but damn. I've always been terrified of vampires. Like, that's... Because I was introduced to my first vampire is Bela Lugosi. Very terrifying actor. Mm-hmm. He just looks creepy. Like, even if you see footage of him just as an actor, he looks fucking creepy. And you could put him, almost cast him in any horror movie. And I don't think I've ever seen him in a role that wasn't in the horror genre. But
yeah, I mean, he's... It's kind of like a double-edged sword because he was like
typecast, as you said,
he was very suited to it, but also because of that, got typecast. I think that was frustrating for him.
Yeah, no Dracula after that has ever terrified me, the way he has.
I can see that. Yeah, as a kid, if you saw, I only saw it as an adult, but I can see if I saw it as a kid,
I saw it as a kid, and it was just terrifying.
I can see that.
But, yeah, it's... I don't even remember where I was going with it. How did I even get there?
You got to Dracula because there was a Buck Rogers episode.
Oh, there's a Buck Rogers episode where there's a space vampire. And I remember as a kid, I was like, God, I hope she could bite me. God, I wish she'd bite me. I wanted her so bad. I would love to be her vampire slave. I don't know. She's victim. Just sexy. Victim, yeah. Bite me some more. So I have a comic book. It's Brave and the Bold, number 107. And I have bought 4 issues. I've been eBaying things lately. And I've bought quite a few books from Paul Kupperberg, who used to be a DC editor and writer for DC Comics.
Yeah.
Selling a lot of his collection.
Oh, really? On eBay?
Yeah, he's very, very reliable, and I like the way he ships the books. And so every time he has it up there, if you like follow him on Facebook, he always puts his eBay listings, and I always check them out, make sure, you know, if there's anything I need. And I saw this Brave and the Bold, several of them that I was missing. I'm missing quite a few Brave and the Bolds, and I just kind of pick them up as I see them. Because they are done in ones for the most part, so you can just get them DC Comics Presents or anything and finish the story. This one is by Creative Team. Believe it or not, they don't even have it on here. That's unbelievable. Usually it's on page one. I know the artist is Aparo. I'm just trying to find who wrote it. And I don't see the credits anywhere, so I don't know who wrote it.
I can look it up while you're talking about it.
Very unprofessional.
Yeah.
Aparo was doing a lot of these, and he has a very distinctive, like, if you ask people, like, who their favorite Batman artist, Aparo might be one of them. He's known for The Death in the Family, and he's known for, he drew a lot of Batman Brave and the Bold and a lot of Batman back in the day. Very distinctive Batman. You know, there's the Neil Adams Batman. There's the Aparo Batman. He's one of those artists that just pops. And this is Brave and the Bold 107, and from 1973. And believe it or not, I didn't realize this, but it's published bi-monthly. So this was a June-July book. And it's starring Black Canary. That's the team-up that's in this book. It starts off with a plane getting ready to crash and Batman and Commissioner Gordon running towards the plane. This plane has been hijacked by a terrorist, and he essentially is demanding $3 million and also the release of a prisoner that Batman just recently captured. So, or else he's going to kill everybody in the plane. So Batman convinces the mayor of the city to give him the $3 million plus release this this villain out of prison. His name is Devlin, and let him go back onto the plane, and then the plane takes off again. But luckily, the pilot is smart enough. He's going to fly them to this place called San Pedro in South America. And he says, because that flight is so long, I'm going to need another co-pilot and also another stewardess. So that's Batman's clue that he could go on in a disguise and get a stewardess to go on with a disguise. So he calls Black Canary to go on as a stewardess. And a couple of times, you know, Black Canary, while they're on the plane, tries to put sleeping pills into their drinks. And it does fall for the guy that escaped from prison, the Devlin guy. He drinks it, falls asleep, and then that other guy, you know, gets pissed off and slaps Black Canary around because he's like, "What did you do? You put my guy to sleep." And he slaps her and knocks her on the floor. And Batman is in the cockpit with the other guys, you know, flying the plane. But Black Canary eventually has it out with this guy with the machine gun and is ready to hand it to him, but the other guy wakes up and hits her on the head. And then these guys are smart. They're not going to land the plane and then escape. They're going to parachute out, so they won't know exactly where they are with the $3 million. So they parachute out, and they put the stewardess, who they don't know is Black Canary, on also a chute because they're going to use her as collateral in case somebody goes after him. And at that time, they do think that Batman's on the plane. So they parachute down, and when they're down there, Black Canary manages to escape from them and put on her outfit. And during this whole time, she never uses her canary cry. On the plane, Batman says, "Don't you dare use the canary cry, because you'll depressurize the ship or poke a hole in the, you know, it's not, she can't like focus it into like a little circle or anything. She kind of just lets it out, and everything goes nuts at this time. So she says, yeah, my ability is going to hamper us on the plane. But once they're off the plane, you think she could use it, but she never uses it. But, she does escape. And then the guy that broke Devlin out of prison pulls the gun on the prisoner, on Devlin, and he says, "Yes, I was the brother of so and so, and you killed him." So now he wants to. This is a revenge story. So he actually broke this guy out of prison to kill him. That's what his thing is, and then take the $3 million, because the $3 million that the other guy was carrying was rocks. And then Emilio, a guy in a poncho, eventually shows up on a horse with some banditos. And they say, "I've heard this on the you know, in the Americas, what was going on, and the $3 million. Give me the $3 million and I'll let you guys go." And they get caught in some crossfire with Emilio Batman, and he's going to put a Gila monster on one of the guys to try to get the $3 million from him, because he stashed it somewhere in an adobe house somewhere back in the way. But they actually take him out, Batman and Black Canary and Emilio, and Emilio lets Batman and Black Canary go because they're under gunfire, and he lets them go because he was just there for the $3 million, and he thinks the $3 million is gone because both of them, the two guys in the plane actually ended up killing each other. Like, well, Emilio didn't shoot him, Batman didn't kill him, Black Canary didn't kill him. They ended up killing each other. They shot each other. And then that's the end of that adventure. And then Emilio takes off. And Batman and Black Canary eventually find the cash in that an adobe place. And that's the end of that adventure. So this guy did all this work, this elaborate planning, just to get this guy out of prison so he can kill him. And also get the $3 million. But that didn't work out. They eventually killed each other.
It was Bob Haney that wrote that story.
Ah, cool.
According to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, at least.
Yeah, it's very interesting that I do not... Oh, and the very last... Oh, my gosh. This is... The credits are on the last page, and they're not like in a little box. Mm-hmm. They're like in the last panel, like if somebody was signing something. It says story by Bob Haney and art by Jim Aparo. That's unusual.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever seen that or noticed it. But it was a pretty cool story. I enjoyed it.
That's cool. Yeah, you're right. That's one nice thing about collecting Brave and the Bold or DC Comics Presents. Whenever you do get an issue, it's usually a done-in-one, so you can go ahead and read it and not have to wait till you get like the next issue or something like that. So I'm not finished with it yet, but I started reading that my next epic collection.
Okay.
The Avengers one. This is the first Avengers one. It's volume 9 in the series of Avengers. It covers 1976 to 1977. And I'm not quite halfway through, but I'm going to talk about a specific issue, but just generally speaking, I mean, it's got a lot of creators involved. Jerry Conway's the first writer. And then it switches over to be mostly Jim Shooter. It looks like about halfway through. And then the final thing in the book is Avengers Annual number 7, which is that early Thanos story. And that's written by Jim Starlin. So he's credited as writer in the beginning of the book. But there's similarly... There's also some writing by Steve Englehart, Bill Mantlow, Stan Lee, Scott Edelman. So this epic collection's got a lot of creators listed. I won't even say all of the artists that are credited, but George Perez is probably the most significant one.
Do you have the issue numbers that this epic collection collects?
Yeah, it collects Avengers 150 through 166. And annuals 6 and 7, as well as Supervillain Team Up number 9 and Marvel 2-in-1 Annual number 2. So I don't know about that 2-in-1 annual, but the reason that it collects Supervillain Team Up number 9 is that it's actually the continuation of Avengers 154. So for whatever reason, the story continues there. Because Avengers 154 is actually what I was going to talk about in a little more detail, but the early part of the book leading up to that is when, for one of the first times since, in a while, because it's issue 150, the Avengers are sitting down to decide on their membership again. And 150 and 151 actually features a lot of, like, it's almost like those TV episodes where that are clip shows where you have like a framing device of the Huxtables or whoever sitting down reminiscing, but then most of the episode is clips. Like, the as they're trying to decide who's going to stay with the team and stuff, there's flashbacks to earlier days in the Avengers. And, you know, I mean, at the time when this issue came out and you couldn't go get these digitally or in a trade or something like that, it probably was kind of cool to have these early adventures recounted. You know, to see the old Iron Man armor and things like that. But, you know, ultimately, the team that they decide on is it's got Captain America, the Wasp, Yellow Jacket. Seems like he's not going to join, but he decides to, when all is said and done, like, you know, being a typical Hank Pym, can't really make up his mind. Iron Man's there, Beast is there, and then Vision and Scarlet Witch. And so everyone else kind of leaves, like Thor and Moondragon and Hellcat and stuff. They're like, you know, if you need us, we'll be back. And
Moondragon, such an interesting costume.
Yeah.
Character design.
Yeah, and then with the bald head.
Yeah.
And one of the things that's going on at this time that's a big part of this these earlier issues is Wonder Man. This is where Wonder Man suddenly comes back from the dead, and there's complications with the Vision because the Vision's like mind is based off of his or whatever. So that's going on when in 154 is written by Jerry Conway with art by George Perez, although he's also credited as storyteller. Jerry Conway is also the editor. Pablo Marcos is the embellisher. And, you know, I love Marvel back in the day because they were just the king of the footnotes and references to other issues.
Yes, I
did that so much.
I love it this for the same reason. It's like it actually makes you want to go follow that story.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously, if you're holding this Epic collection, you've read what it references when it first starts out, but there's this little thing on the front page that tells you everything that's going on and, you know, has happened recently. If you didn't read the last issue in Giant Size Avengers number 6 or annual number 6 that had also recently come out. And if, you know, with the Epic collection, you just read those, but the time tells you what else to pick up. But Wonder Man is back from the dead, and then also the Wizard is around. And I don't know this history. Maybe you can fill it in. But the Wizard, he's talking like he's Scarlet Witch and Quicksilver's father. I don't remember. Did he end up just being wrong about that, or
I guess so because it's Magneto. So
right, but I can't remember how
the Wizard. I vaguely remember from like the Invaders and stuff, you know.
Yeah, and then he's an older man.
The golden age,
right?
Marvel before Stan Lee came.
Yeah, and he's here as an older man. Like he has gray hair, and he's like kind of like how the you know JSA. Were pre 52 with like Jay Garrick and stuff, how they're like still like they're really in really good shape for old men, but they're still depicted as older men. It's kind of like that. But so yeah, this story deals with Atuma.
And Atuma.
Atuma.
Atuma. It's Atuma.
Yeah. this deals with Atuma and Wonder Man has a biopsy, and the Avengers sit around at the pathology lab and wait for the report. No. Atuma, he's the blue-skinned Atlantean fellow who was always trying to take over Atlantis from Namor, and they even like give you a footnote of times in the past that tells you to see supervillain team up number 3 and Fantastic Four number 33, which is when he, I guess, first started to try to take over this Submariner. But he's attacking the Hydro base, which I think the Avengers built the Hydro base just so that it could be regularly attacked by Atuma and other supervillains, because like, that's all that ever seems to happen at the Hydro base is the Avengers have to. It's like seems to be quite a liability. But and it was kind of interesting to read this because I remember a very similar plot, like I said, when involving Atuma and the Hydra base, where in like the 300s that I read when I was a kid, when I think like Quasar was on the Avengers and stuff. That seems, I don't, at least from my recollection, seems to be kind of similar to this. But as I said, what's kind of interesting is that it actually, the story actually is to be continued, but it continues into supervillain team up number 9, and it's a totally different creative team. It's actually written by Bill Mantlo, and the art is actually by Jim Shooter and S. Trapani. So I don't know.
Did you mention that the cover to 154 is Kirby? Wow, it's a Kirby cover.
Oh, it is?
Yes.
Okay. They don't,
it's freaking awesome.
They have cover credits in here. I didn't even notice that. I wonder if he's credited. Okay, yeah, he's not credited in the issue, but they have him credited as a penciler in the front page of the trade.
Yeah, that is an awesome cover. I don't have this. I actually have this issue. It's the only issue I have, like, in the surrounding books.
Okay, so there's actually on the wall behind, like the brick wall behind Captain America's head, there's a little JK. That's the only sign of Kirby. But yeah, it's floating heads of Cap, Wonder Woman, Scarlet Witch, and Iron Man looking below them at the Vision in chains by Atuma and his Smurf warriors. But I've actually like the blue skin though. It's always popped for me. Like I always, especially against the armor that they wear.
Yeah.
And I always thought it was kind of neat looking against the,
you love the old Submariner issues then.
Yeah. So,
Daryl IM'd me. He wants to come on and listen to the Avengers. So,
okay. Yeah, bring him in.
Daryl is my co-host on DC Noise for listeners that don't know that.
Yeah, I wonder if there is anybody that doesn't know that.
Could be, because I think there's a couple people that only listen to Retro.
They're afraid of DC Noise.
Well, DC Noise is its own. It could put people into shock. I think you even made a remark about that when you first listened to it. You're like, what the hell is this? I think it's a hard podcast to just jump in on because it's a lot of inside jokes.
Right. Yeah, the first time I listened to it, I wasn't sure what was going on because you guys just started talking. Like there was no introduction or
yeah, it's just like half the people don't even know which one is which. Like
I'm like, what's going on here? And I stopped listening and then I was like, I don't know what drew me back to it, but I was like, well, I'm going to give it another shot. And I started getting intrigued and entertained by it. And like I think at that point Daryl's already on the show, and I think I went back and listened to like the show from when Daryl joined.
Yeah.
So then I knew all like.
That's when it got very different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I've heard older episodes too.
Yeah, it was a lot kind of like this.
Yeah,
similar in style.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I like. It's funny to hear sometimes.
So you did read the supervillain team up, and then the issues before 154, correct?
Correct. That's where I'm at. Is just right after the supervillain team up, and the supervillain team up does bring in Dr. Doom to everything.
Yeah, because it's Submariner, Dr. Doom, usually.
Yeah. And so that's not any different here. But it is a little bit of a jar to go from George Perez to Jim Shooter on art. But it's not that bad. I haven't really seen much Jim Shooter art.
Those Epic collections really pique my interest, but I'm so into the single issues that I'm going to do the single issue route, but I'm on the Avengers kick. The Epic collection that I'm really interested in is the Cap one.
Mm.
Because I would expect there to be a lot of the era that I already own, but I'd like on the shelf to pull it out again.
Yeah.
So I'm a real, real fond of the Grenwald Cap, you know. And not a lot of that is collected, so I would imagine that would show up in the Epic collection. Has there been a Cap Epic? I noticed in the latest previews there's an Epic Cap.
You know, I can tell you exactly about it in 1 second here, because I wrote down all the upcoming ones and talked about them on the last episode of Myth Making, etc. There hasn't been a Cap one yet. The first one comes out on March 4th. It's called Dawn's Early Light, and it collects Captain America 247 through 266 and Captain America Annual number 5.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first one. And they haven't said what the second one's going to be yet. So it seems like they're doing a cycle of 6.
Yeah.
It goes Iron Man, Thor, Spider-Man, Avengers, Fantastic Four, Cap. And the way that they have them coming out, it seems like they're just going to do like a cycle of 6 like that. They're just going to go.
Which is your favorite so far? I mean, you've done Thor, you've done Spider-Man, you've done Avengers, you did Iron Man. They're roughly in the same period. Well, kind of in the same period. This Avengers one seems earlier.
Yeah, this is the earliest one, I think. And the other ones, are all kind of like 80s. So they've all been appealing to me. I don't know if I've heard enough of the Avengers one yet to judge it against the other ones. But I think the Thor one maybe was... It might be like the Thor and then the Iron Man, the Spider-Man. But Spider-Man also was the one that actually had issues in it that I read when I was a kid. So that was the one that was the most nostalgic. So hard to say.
Yeah, it's a interesting thing. I just don't like I don't mind the format. I just don't mind it not starting. I'm such a completist. I just can't fathom jumping in at some random
reading out
point.
Of order.
Yeah.
You got Keith Knutson disease.
Yeah. Daryl.
Yes.
Welcome. You got the itch to talk some Avengers, so we're talking some Avengers. Chris just talked about Avengers number 154 from the Epic Collection.
Ah, welcome to the Retrocast, Daryl. It's good to talk to you again.
Yes, Keith can stay awake now. You have it. Can wake back up.
Yeah, he's not hitting the road ties.
Exactly.
That's how the Buck Rogers thing sounds. Like when they take out of the ships out of the deck, it sounds like you're hitting those road wedges.
I've only done that twice. I don't advocate that at all.
Well, yeah. Interesting enough, I'm going to talk Avengers too. I'm doing this eBay thing where every week I go and buy, I don't know, the next issue or the next 3 issues. In this case, I got 3 issues. I had just gotten into the Avengers again because of the Red Wolf. I'm like getting all his appearances. In the last episode, I covered the Red Wolf issues, And the Avengers were breaking up. At least they were splintered. Black Panther wanted to do his own thing. The main guys wanted to go after Zodiac, and then the others wanted to help Red Wolf. So they were splintered, and now they don't kind of mention them being splintered anymore. It just Cap and Iron Man and those guys went to go after Zodiac, and then all of a sudden in issue 82, they're captured, all of them, except for the ones that are outside the dome, which are the ones that were with Red Wolf, Goliath, Vision, and Scarlet Witch. They can't do anything to help. Spider-Man is having a crisis because this all happens in Manhattan, and Zodiac is like, they know what to do. This is a 15-cent comic, and I just went over Batman and Black Canary. The ransom in Brave and the Bold was like $3 million, and that was a 20-cent comic from DC. And the ransom in this one, when they're holding the whole city of Manhattan under ransom, he's asking for $3 billion. So he's asking for a lot more, which is more realistic, I guess, if you have all of Manhattan captured. So Spider-Man's there. The Fantastic Four are nowhere to be seen. They're outside of the dome on Manhattan. They're worthless. They want to help, but they can't. Spider-Man's there. He's having a crisis. His Aunt May, I guess, is close to a heart attack or something.
Again.
And he doesn't want to stress her out. Yeah, he doesn't want to leave. So he doesn't help. And the Black Panther had recently teamed up with Daredevil, so he actually goes to save Matt Murdock, and then they actually end up helping defeat the Zodiac. But this is what I don't like about it, is Zodiac is like an organization of all the different, you know, Leo and all those different symbols. This guy is there's only one dude that's holding this whole Manhattan, and he's got the key, you know, that Zodiac key. I guess it's pretty powerful.
Yeah, it is.
He's the only one of the Zodiac crew that's captured Cap, Iron Man, Quicksilver, and Thor, all the big guns, pretty much. And he gets defeated by Daredevil and Black Panther, who are not. I mean, Black Panther's mind, he's more powerful by his mind and leadership than I think he is. I mean, he's an awesome fighter, but he's not like super powered. He has vibranium claws and that kind of stuff, but he's not like a super powered dude. Him and Daredevil actually team up, and Daredevil manages to take down the device that's holding the other Avengers captive, and then all hell is restored because Zodiac can't do anything. His men turn on him. I mean, his men can't. Once you lose, it's almost like Buck Rogers. Do you know how they went after the quarterback in the fight scene? Mm-hmm. And they took out the big pilot. Once they took out this guy, all the other guys just ran away and like cowards. And Manhattan was restored.
No more morale.
Yeah. This is. And then everybody seems to get along pretty dang good after the splinter in the last six or so issues, where they all don't believe the Avengers are going in the right direction. But this was by Roy Thomas and John Buscema, which I like his art a lot. Like,
oh yeah,
it's he has a good run, and that's why I'm kind of happy. Just keep the Avengers run going. Number 83, I was very interested in because it has Valkyrie. It's the first appearance of Valkyrie, or so you think. Okay, dun, dun, dun. It says it's the first appearance of Valkyrie, and it looks like Valkyrie, but it's not really Valkyrie. But this is a very interesting comic because Valkyrie comes. When I read it, I was like, "Man, she is a bitch," because she like tries to form these liberators, which is like the Lady Liberators with Wasp, Medusa, Black Widow, and Wanda, the Scarlet Witch. And she's like, these men are chauvinist pigs, and you need to join my team so we can take out these men Avengers because they've treated you like shit. She gives her origin story, and then her origin story is where I kind of like said, something's not right here. That doesn't, because I've been reading Defenders forever, and I'm like, this isn't copacetic. Something's not right. But I didn't quite put two and two together yet. But the male Avengers are invited to a thing in Vermont where a bunch of, you know, powerful people are having like a costume party, and they're having a float thing, and they're going to go on the float as the actual Avengers. And they run into the Masters of Evil, you know, Claw, the Melter,
mm-hmm.
all those, the mm-hmm. Whirlwind. And they attack to try to capture this particular device that one of the professors has. I don't know why it's on a float, but it happens to be there. And then the Lady Liberators come, and they kind of rescue the day first. Oh, Radioactive Man is the other one that's there. So the Avengers are fighting. Man, the Vision is freaking powerful. I gotta think he's gotta be one of the most powerful Avengers because of what he could do. But yeah,
they forget about him.
Yeah, they often put him as like a side note, but the fact that he can have anything pass through him, and then he can change his density and
to diamond.
Yeah, and then he could kill you if he wanted to if he's not careful, because he always does that thing where he phases his hand into people's hearts. Mm-hmm. All he has to do is solidify, and you're gonna be dead.
I know,
but he just does it like, I don't know how he manages to do it, but just for like a split second when they kind of like have a little bit of a heart attack, but it doesn't quite give him a heart attack. But anyway, Valkyrie, this is, I guess, the first appearance of Valkyrie in costume, but it's not really the Valkyrie we know from the Defenders. It's really the Enchantress. Right. So she's manipulating them to go after the Avengers.
That bitch.
But they are like male chauvinists, because even when the adventure's over, I think Hank Pym, he's Goliath at this time, he says, "You birds finally learned your lesson about that women's lib bull." And then Scarlet Witch says, "That's what you think, male chauvinist, big."
So yeah, when you posted that to Facebook, I was laughing because that just reminded me, because in the very first issue in this trade, this episode 150 or issue 150, they're all still gathering together in the meeting room, and Yellow Jacket and Wasp show up, and Thor greets them and says, "You do seem fit as Asgardian he-goats." and Janet's like, "Why, thank you, Goldilocks. That's the nicest thing you ever called me." "Nay, it's a compliment." "I know, never mind." But so Scarlet Witch says, "Have a seat, Jan. I need some support on a motion to revive the Lady Liberators." And Iron Man says, "Very funny, Wanda." But yeah, actually has an asterisk to see issue number 83.
That's interesting.
So if readers at the time want to do some research on the Lady Liberators.
The first appearance of the Lady Liberators, and the person that joined them is the Enchantress for other things. The Enchantress gets blasted by Scarlet Witch in this issue, and it like ports her somewhere, and you don't know where she went. You think she like phased away. But she actually went to wherever Archon lives. He's the guy with the lightning bolts and looks like Conan. That's always trying to marry Scarlet Witch. Mm, but right. That leads us into 84, which is a totally Black Knight issue, which is kind of cool because the Black Knight has his ebony blade and he's losing control. Like he's almost like turning into the Punisher, like where he wants to kill people.
Yeah, that went on for a long time.
Yeah. He's going to this place to put his sword into this thing, which is like a volcano looking thing, so he can be done with it, because he thinks the ebony blade's taking over his mind and turning him evil, and that's when Akron the Magnificent shows up with his lightning bolts and starts blasting the Black Knight, and he starts to fall to his death, and Wanda is asleep, and she starts screaming, "Help!" in her bed. And there Keith Knutson comes to the bed real quick
Well, he doesn't know. He never gets there right away.
He came really slow.
He trips over the beer bottles.
He tripped over the beer bottles, and he shows up. But Quicksilver gets there, and all the other Avengers are there. Are you okay? You know, is everything okay? And she just says what her vision is, and they don't know what if it's real or not. They don't believe her. They say, "Oh, she's just dreaming.
Oh, she's just being a woman."
Yeah, she's just being help.
That's how they talk.
So Quicksilver uses his brain, and he says, "Well, I think I'm just gonna call to Dane's servant over there. Dane's Alfred Pennyworth's answers the phone, and he says, "No, I don't know where Dane is. He hasn't been around for a long time." So then they believe her. So then they need Thor, who can use his hammer to get them to the location they need to be at. And I guess what this is the Enchantress is with Akron, and he wants to get the Avengers back there so he could threaten the Avengers and then get Scarlet Witch to be his bride. I guess that happens in earlier issues, and this is just bringing her back so he can take her for his mate. But Thor and the Black Panther arrive a little late. Enchantress teleports them, the Avengers that are there, over to this planet. They're attacked by Akron's men. And Black Bolt is... not Black Bolt. What the hell am I talking about? The guy, the teleporter from DC Comics that is a mercenary? No, I'm not talking about that.
No.
Well, that's Bolt. Black Bolt is the Inhuman.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about Black Knight. She's got that flirtation thing or that mystical thing where she could put people under her spell. Like if she could put Daryl under her spell, she'd say, "Lick my feet," and then you'd be there.
Well, she wouldn't need a spell. I mean,
she wouldn't need to tell you anything. You'd betray your friends.
Yeah.
It's just a regular old question.
Yeah.
No magic involved.
But I can have the sex. I'm done. All of you are betrayed.
Me and Keith would, and you would be, Chris would be betrayed.
Yeah, pretty much. So I would say sorry a minute later because it ain't going to take me long. I'd be done, and then I'd be like, "I'm sorry, fellas. I'm going to let you out.
I'm done."
I'm letting you out. I'm sorry.
I feel so bad now.
It won't happen again until she says I can have it again.
Until you recharge.
Yeah.
I'll be tired for a while, so it's safe.
Yeah,
safe till I
feel my feet again.
So she essentially has Dane fighting Thor, and that's when the Ebony Blade falls into that volcano just by accident, and then Akron believes why Black Knight was really there. And it doesn't say what happens to Black Knight, because I think once he loses his Ebony Blade, you know, what good is he? I don't know. He's got the
flames. Yeah, that's happened before. Like, they didn't know what to do, and when he lost the blade again later, and like in the 90s, and he had to get like a fake-ass lightsaber.
Oh, that's when he used the technology, yeah.
Yeah, because he's a scientist, he tinkers. He likes to tinker with stuff, so.
So I guess he's got the flying horse, but that's how it ends. It just they're still on the planet, and they're saying, Thor says, "I'll get you back." And Akron wants to apologize. He wants to say, you know, "I didn't believe what Dane was telling me, and it was legit." And Thor's like, "Hey, we're hot-headed right now. Let's leave. We don't want your damn apology." And he takes off. And that's how it ends. And it doesn't say how Dane... What happens to him, but maybe in issue 85, I don't know. We'll find out if I win the next eBay auction.
We shall see.
Dane will probably have a toga party and invite them, and they'll be friends again.
Yeah. Well, he did a lot of trying to prove himself. Like he was one of those Avengers who always felt like he had to, I'm no Captain America. I have to really... Mm-hmm.
There was quite a few of them that had to prove themselves. Clint,
The swordsman,
Hawkeye, the swordsman. Hank Pym has always been second.
Yeah, they make him such a
Tony Stark and everybody else. So he's always. That's kind of probably what made him go. his identity crisis. He always had one. He's like, Batman, am I Yellow Jacket? Am I Goliath? Am I, you know, who am I now?
Well, it was funny how Hank Pym, because it's editorial craziness, he got, like, he would go, he would make it and be confident and his career would start to get better. And then another editor would come in and it'd be like, nah, I want you to switch it up. And then he would fall from grace again or change personas. And then he would have to go through a whole all over again. Mm-hmm. So he suffered from a fight between the writers and certain editors that didn't really like the character much.
Yeah.
So
the women Avengers aren't treated too well in this time. They really are. They really are treated like secondary.
Mm-hmm. Wasp got to what it took, like, I'm trying to remember how long it took for Wasp to become leader, and she got so much shit from Thor.
Yeah, the 80s, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know when I was covering that Under Siege storyline, that's when she's the leader of the Avengers, and Hercules at the time is not too happy about it.
Mm-mm.
Hercules is still, like, questioning her.
Well, he got beat like a bitch, though, later on, anyway. He was gone. He wasn't there that long while she was there.
No, I mean, he ends up really in bad. He ends up in a coma in that story.
Uh-huh.
Black Widow was the leader of the Avengers at one time, too, wasn't she?
It was during Dan, when he had the... I think it was during when he had the lost the sword, and he had the other sword. He had the one he made. The
lightsaber.
Yeah, the lightsaber. I think it was during that time that she was leader of the Avengers.
And when Cap lost his shield, he had his little... wrist shit.
Yeah, he had the wrist. It's been, I think it was three women have been the leaders of the Avengers. It's been Captain Wasp, Captain Marvel, and Black Widow. Those have been the three.
I don't remember Captain Marvel, but that must have happened in the
Monica, late, she came
late,
in
late 80s or early
90s? No, after Masters of Evil, after Hercules got beat, Cap went to her. Captain America went to Monica and asked her to be the leader, to take over, because the Wasp was leaving. She tried to leave a while. Like, she's been, you know, she was trying to go out and do her own thing for a little bit, get a break. She-Hulk was there. She-Hulk had left to go to to the Fantastic Four to cover for the Thing leaving. So yeah, that was a change up, and then she came. She took over, and then that evil pedophile, what was his name?
Dr. Druid.
Dr. Druid.
He wanted. I knew you were talking for.
You knew it. The little creep. He wanted to be the leader. Actually, Dr. Druid was hanging out with Black Knight when Black Knight came back. He was hurt, but he was healing, and he came back to the Avengers because they were shorthanded, and he. He hung around with the Black Knight, and that's how he got on the team, because he just hung out with him. They had a mission going on, and he just happened to be there and helped out. And then he sat there going, let me study them, because he saw She-Hulk, and he was like, let me stay with this team for a little bit and study her.
Study her, I'm sure.
Yeah, I want to study She-Hulk too, but you don't have to be a creep about it. Just tell her.
Now, he always seemed like a shyster, like,
he was.
He had his own agenda, and he almost seemed like a pervert.
He showed up. Almost, he was.
He was a pervert.
He showed up. He showed up during Under Siege at the Avengers Mansion because he saw it on TV. Mm-hmm. He was sitting there watching TV, and his PR guy, his assistant guy, and he's like, he saw opportunity. I'm going down there.
Based on the life of Daryl Taylor.
I'm watching TV.
He's sitting there watching TV. I want to join in on this.
I want to get in on this.
There's some sexy women over there.
Sexy women. I rub his feet.
He gets his Kirk. I want a green woman.
Yeah. You just say you want a green woman. Like, he would just be y'all, you know, like, I'm hanging out to help the people. And then in his thought bubble, it'll be like, if I could convince her to come back to my apartment later on, I can rub chocolate sauce all over her and do what I want. But that was his whole thing. He wanted to be leader of the Avengers from back then. Like, he was thinking, I should be leader. But he wouldn't say it out loud because he'd get bitch slapped. But he would. Mm-hmm. But that was his thing. Like, he wanted to be on the team. And slowly, as everybody, because this was the time when all the big guns were kind of going through different things. Like, Thor was going through his body. Hell had put that curse on him where his body, his bones were going to, were grinding. They were turning into brittle bones. So he had that armor on him. But he couldn't die. He was still immortal, so he couldn't die. So he had to use the armor to fight. Then you had Cap had kind of, he was going through his little,
problems. America.
Yeah, with America, and he
was
had
a... Was that where he had the black suit, or...?
Not yet. He still had he didn't give it up yet. He still had the mantle, but he was still having issues with that. And Iron Man was off. He was gone. I think he was going to the... I think he did the West Coast thing, or he was already...
I thought Rhodey was with the West Coast. I don't remember him...
Well, ever. When he went when the West Coast thing happened, he was drunk first, and then he got sober, and he joined the West Coast Avengers anyway.
Mm.
So, but either way, it was like either he was going through his drinking problem. I think he was going through his drinking problems back then. So he had left. Either that, or he was just so busy going through stuff, fighting for his company or whatever, and he just decided he couldn't do both at that time. So he left. So all of the big guns were kind of busy, and that's when...
It's like Justice League Detroit.
Yeah.
It's like, you got Black Knight, you have Druid.
That's how I turned into, like, little by little.
Marvel.
I mean, they got Namor on the team, really, for the first time. He was a full-time member.
Well, they needed somebody that had strength.
Well, and they got him, because he was there, and his wife, his issues with his wife getting turned into a creature.
And let's add some jackets on. Let's have the Avengers jackets.
That was the best time,
let's
man.
Let's have Avengers some pockets.
Jackets. I'm telling you, Avengers
put some
jackets.
Pockets. You need to carry stuff. Let's be more practical.
With the A on it.
Yeah.
Team jackets are awesome.
And you got more pockets. You could carry stuff.
You damn right. You get your phone in there. You put your cell phone in one pocket and
you put your wallet in the other. Taylor Network. Jackets.
Team I'm
jackets.
Working on it. I gotta Taylor get Network. Those. Yeah, we need Taylor Network jackets with the big T on it.
They had
challenge
in the Buck Rogers episode that we watched, they had to protect themselves from the sun, they had
gold plate
hooded jumpsuits. So Mike,
that's right.
We're gonna get those for the retrocast.
That's right. And they had the little things on them, like the way they were, looked like some type of padding or something.
At least the costumes were equal opportunity, because the women's costumes were tight, but the men's costumes were tighter.
Oh, my God.
I mean, Gil Gerard barely fit in that thing. I mean,
you see, he was bloated. He walked around like Keith. He was Buck Rogers. Yeah,
he didn't have, like, tight abs. He was like, he was like a regular-sized dude. He wasn't like us. Quite as big, but
he wears the tight pants, and he used to. I bet you when he put on his thing, he used to tell people, "I can't. You got to hold my wallet because I can't put my wallet."
Who was the guy that played Duke again? What was the actor? Do you remember?
David Groh.
David Groh. He had a trouble fitting into that suit.
I bet he did.
It was a little too tight.
Mm-hmm. And then they were white, so if you farted too much. You know, had train tracks, you would see everything. It would be all.
But we had Sweaty Wilma in this. She was sexy.
She was in a pit. She is so sexy. I swear, I love her. She smells good too.
She was in a Schwitz.
Yeah, they put her in a slave dress and threw her in the Schwitz.
with Chuck from Star Joe's.
I remember that. But I'd rather go to the one she went to.
That's what I said.
He goes to the one where the sweaty, sweaty man. I'm a sweaty man myself. I could just sit alone and sweat. I don't need to go somewhere.
You don't need to get a sauna for that.
I don't need to go nowhere. Just wait for the summertime and let me sit there for a minute.
Just walk at a con for about 12
minutes. Yeah, man, you want to see sweaty men? Just wait for us to walk around a con. Yeah, that's you'll see. Just let the DC Noise walk around the con for an hour. That's sweaty men's right there. That's it.
Insta We're all sweat.
Remember when I first met Keith? This is so off topic. But when I first met Keith and he'd go to a con, he dressed up, man. He'd
wear
his Dockers. He'd wear like a nice shirt. And his shirt would always have these sweat stains.
I know the pictures. Like, why are you wearing a button-down shirt?
Why are you dressing up for work?
This is a con, man. These people, there are people here that smell like ass. There are like 30% of the people here that smell like ass. Then you have cosplayers dressed up as, you know, characters. And then you have regular people in t-shirts and stuff. Like, why are you?
You're dressed up.
You don't have to do that. You could just be cool.
And then he got confused and he said, well, I don't want to dress up. I'll wear jeans next time. He's like, but his jeans were like three sizes too small.
Oh, my God.
Just like, Gil Gerard pants. Except he couldn't even fit in his pants.
I think Keith was a model back in the day, and he just can't stop dressing like that. I think that's what it was. Because his sweat stains would be so big in his t-shirt, you could see it. Every picture he takes, when he takes his arm around somebody, the sweat stains is like as big as the head. Because it's so hot.
It's hot.
It's hot in them damn. All that body heat is hot. It's too damn hot for that.
Your pants are too tight when you can't fit a hotel key. I'm not talking about hotel keys from the 70s. I'm talking about the electronic keys that are flat. One of those flat keys wouldn't fit in his pants.
And he walk around uncomfortable all day.
I don't know why. Trying to bring the class.
I don't know why.
The class to the show.
I don't know why. He got the rest of us walking around burping and with our shorts and t-shirts, Superman t-shirts on and stuff.
But now he's adapted. Now he wears t-shirts.
Yeah, he got no choice. He had to. It's too hot. He's going to pass out. He can't do that no more.
He adapted. He's shorts and t-shirts.
And shorts he can wear. Like, he can, I mean, pants he can wear. He
yeah.
Can
fit. They fit.
Oh, man.
So that was a tangent. But, Chris, did you read anything else? That was all I read this week.
Yeah, that's pretty much it for me. Like I said, I got about half of this epic collection left to go. We'll see how the rest of this goes. But and then the next one that's coming out of these is the Fantastic Four one. It's the first one that actually has issues in it that I actually have in my collection. So I'm gonna pick it up and see how I feel about double dipping, because I'm not a big double dipper. I avoid it a lot, but like you were saying, Mike, about the Captain America volumes, like that you might want for the convenience of pulling it off the shelf.
Yeah.
I don't know. So we'll see. Because we'll see how I feel about it once I have it. Because there are some other ones coming up, it looks like, that do have some issues that I haven't single issue. So we'll see. But the form factor for these, I mean, they're just like the perfect size for me.
They look like good reading books.
Yeah. That's what I mean. Yeah. So
it's not like reading an omnibus where you have to kind of read it on the floor or the table. You ain't gonna hold it.
And yeah, I have to protect myself because I drop these things on my face a lot. I read in bed and
You're reading up and you fall asleep in
the books. Yeah, exactly. The other night, especially if I have a few beers, I think I'm gonna stay up all night. Like I try to be Keith Knutson and I can't do it. So
adrenaline doesn't work like Keith. The more Keith drinks, the more stamina he gets. He's like Dr. Johnny Fever on WKRP.
No, it only affects my mind. I think I can stay up, but then so I had a couple beers and I got in bed and I was all ready to read some of my epic collection. Next thing I know, Kara's picking the book up off my face and taking my glasses off and turning the light off for me. And I didn't even read like a page. I just laid down, opened up the book, and then just like dropped it on my face.
I did that with my iPad a couple of days ago. I woke up with it in my hand but I love my iPad so much that I did not move. Like I woke up with it. My hands were still on it, holding it partially.
Yeah.
And I looked at it in the middle of the night and I said, why do I have this thing Why is my iPad looking at me? Why is it over my face?
I'm glad I read single issues because it doesn't hurt when I drop it on my face.
So omnibuses are dangerous. Those are too heavy.
Yeah, they hurt.
I'll break my nose.
Yeah. Speaking of Buck Rogers, I got issue one from the Gold Key run. And I also got issue one from the Whitman, based on the TV show. So I'm going on that tangent. My attention deficit disorder on back issues is all over the fucking place.
Have you ever read any Buck Rogers in back issue format?
The only Buck Rogers that I ever read in comic book format was those big ones, the Treasury edition. I had the movie adaptation in Treasury size. I think I still have it. I just got to find it.
You go everywhere to get comics. You do eBay. You do what?
My comic shop is my favorite.
A comic shop, you do DCBS, you do your own comic shop. I mean, there are no comics going out. All the comics are coming into your house.
Unless they're my brothers.
Like, what are you doing, man? What are you doing? Your house is going to topple down in comics eventually. It's going to be comics in the windows.
We had the water heater guy come because our water heater busted, and he was down there. It's like, my God, I've never seen it. What is all this shit? He said, I've never seen anything like it. He's like, do you own a store?
You could. You damn well could.
He's like, God damn.
I don't know how you do keep all that paper in your house, man. It's too much. I went crazy. I had to get rid of it. I did. I went absolutely nuts. The only thing bad about it is there's some stuff you just can't get on digital. Like, I want all the Avengers stuff, but it stops. Like, it starts and stops.
I thought you'd like to come in on this chat because we both had read Avengers, not planning on it, but coincidentally. But I've been on the Avengers kick, and I got in with – I do my, like, character I start following a character, so I was like, I want to complete Red Wolf, and Red Wolf led me to the Avengers. And then these damn little bubbles that say continued or – you could follow the story in this book.
They get you.
I start following that chain, and the continuity is very good in old Marvel.
I know. They get you every time, I swear.
It's very good.
Yeah.
Daryl, have you just been grabbing and reading random Avengers issues on digital, or have you been kind of reading order?
I can't do random. I kind of go through I'll go through storylines. Like recently, I read what they had available. They had a lot of the Iron Man stuff from before when he was going through his drinking problem. Like, I had read all of that stuff up until, like, it stops at right before he does the Armor Wars. Like, he just discovers that somebody's been, you know, that Hammer had been using his suit and stuff. Like, so it stops right before that, but it's a long run of like 10 issues straight where it slowly starts, you know, like he slowly starts to climb. He's banging his bodyguard, Bethany. His secretary's yelling at him because he's never in his office when he's supposed to be. And he killed that Russian, not Russian, but he killed this politician because they activated his repulsor rays right when he was talking at the podium. I guess that was a big cover thing where you see the cover and you see the repulsor ray beam go straight through the guy's chest on the cover.
Nice.
And I love that stuff. Like, that was so I'll do it like runs. Like, I've done runs of like Kree versus the Skrulls. I've done that runs.
I'm actually getting close to that. If you talk issue numbers, like, I'm on 82 or 84. I think I got the Kree Skrull things coming up.
Yeah, you're close.
I'm very close. I think I'm like within 10 issues or so.
Yeah. So I love it. Like, I have issues 90 of Avengers all the way to What did it go to? 118. So I have it up to that on digital. Nice. And then they added some recently that I'm going to wind up getting more of, because I see now that I'm looking at it, I see they added some more shit. So now they got me. They got me another $20. I'm going to have to buy this stuff. But yeah, that's how I do it. I do it like run, and they contain them like runs. It'll be like Captain Marvel's storyline. And I'm talking about the original one, the Kree one, the Kree soldier one, his story. They'll piece together some of his issues and then some of the issues that he crossed over into with the Avengers. It's up to him and Rick Jones are stuck together and they're sharing the same body and they have to switch over. And he's starting to see things. Like, it's up to that part.
Nice.
With that. So I got that. And so that's how I do it. I do it like that. They do it. And then if they do a sale, it gets me in there. And then I get like Mike and I buy some of it. And then I look and see, well, I don't want to finish. I mean, I want to finish the story. I don't want to just stop. Mm-hmm. And I'll just keep going and pushing that damn button.
It's cheaper and more easy to do it when you push a button than it is to got to go seek it out, pay shipping, and
yeah, I'm lazy too. I don't.
That's why I kind of just say I want to do 2 to 3 a week, but I think I'm gonna keep on the Avengers and just keep going forward, because these 15-cent issues and the 20-cent issues, I never read those. When I get the 30-cent issues, that's when I started reading it, around the Shooter era and the the Perez and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. When Beast was there.
No, I was saying, for me, the team books, it's always fascinated me. The lineup changes in the Avengers was always great for that. I always like seeing the different members come and go and who joins and seeing this lineup and then that lineup and why people come and go, what their reasons for it are and stuff.
Well, now
and Avengers is great like that.
You get to look that stuff up now and you can see, I like hearing the guys that were working during that time talk about it. Like, this is what happened when they were working on this and why they had to leave and the editor stuff. Like, I love hearing the editors, like, we were pulling him away to do this book. So that's why we pulled him out of, we pulled him off of a run, like in mid run or they quit. Like a lot of, like they talk about creators now quitting, a lot of them quit back then. Like they got fired and quit a lot, and you never got answers. Like you would start reading something, and the next thing you know, like 5 issues, you have like 5 different writers on one book, and you don't know why. Every issue is a different writer.
I think editors had more control back then.
They did.
I mean, and it was like. And the writer would just get frustrated, or Kirby was tough. He'd say, "Fuck you. You're not going to make me redraw this page, motherfucker."
Well, there was no committee back then. There was most head, whoever was in charge, they were just in charge. It was one guy. And he would answer to the board of directors in terms of how much money they made the year, for that year. If sales go down, that's the only thing they want to know. What's going on?
It is very interesting because, usually you hear a lot of articles about, oh, here's the Stanley article or here's the Kirby article. So you see perspectives like that. But there was a Paul Kupperberg article that was recently published by Bob Retall turned it on to me because he's always interested. He's, where do you fall on this on the Kirby standpoint? And it was an editor perspective of the, roughly that time. And it's very interesting how much power like some of these editors had. It was, you're going to do this. I don't like what you're doing.
Well, they had agendas. Certain editors, there was a few editor who had arguments when he was a writer. He had a beef with a certain writer, another certain writer. And then when he was made head editor, the first thing he did was fuck with that guy to the point where he just left. like it was that bad. Like he would cancel. Like he knew when he got in, I'm canceling your book. He was like, he would change up things. He would make him change this. He would change that. He would take the popular artists away from the book. Like, editors and stuff, you think shit is now, like, you know, people get into this thing where, oh, DC is full of, and Marvel and how, you know, people are treated so badly now.
They don't know what it was like, man.
They don't know.
They don't even have a clue.
There was no such thing. As you go on to Twitter and you can complain or you can speak up and talk about it or whatever. None of that. Like back then, they can come in and basically say you're fired without reason. Mm-hmm. Or they can come in and tell you you have to change up every single part. And they've done it. Like the editors have. There are editors who will basically don't like you. Straight up will say they don't like you. And they went through that. Like that's why you see so many, you know, books where changes happened.
Right, editors changed, and you were maybe on the good side of one editor, and then all of a sudden, the new guy's there, and he's like, "I don't like you at all."
Christopher Priest is a good example. He was very cool with Jim Shooter when he hired him at a very young age to be an editor, and he was very, you know, he was cool with him. So when Jim Shooter was kicked out, guess what?
Yeah.
You were part of, it was like an army.
Well Shooter was like my way or the highway, right? I mean, he ruled kind of like hard rules. And if you were a young guy coming under him and fell under his mentorship, it was easier to probably accept than if you were an older guy and all of a sudden this jackass is telling you all this stuff.
Like Jim Shooter came up with things that are important to this day, like he keeping the books on time, making sure that
every issue is complete as a reading like a first issue kind of thing.
Right, at crossovers that people swear they hate, but when they come out, everybody buys it.
They like, bitch and complain, but they can't stay away.
They can't stay away. Like that kind of stuff was things he came up with, and keeping the books on time and how you work out a thing. The bad thing is he was bad with people. So he was a terrible communicator when it comes to dealing with
a genius for, I think, quality.
Like, well, yeah, you look at Valiant.
Valiant or Broadway or Defiant, they were all methodically crafted universes that were well thought out.
And when they got rid of him, they failed.
Yeah.
When the things that he felt were important, like, you know, you're not going to join with this other company because it'll weaken the product.
Yeah.
Like, you keep people on books, you know, that they have a certain run. You want to keep the people on those books and for them to work right. Like, once he was gone and they went crazy with all the video games and the crossovers and the whole thing, and they were badly done crossovers, like, you know, like not good. They were badly done. So like people hated Marv Wolfman because of Crisis. Like all the way back then, other writers and stuff were angry because he was the main guy for a minute. Like if he wanted whatever came out of Crisis was what your book had to reflect. And he got shit for that.
I just thought Crisis, though, was so freaking mind-blowing. Like, as a consumer of it, I was like, hell yeah.
It was to us, but we didn't know. There was no thing
I know. That's kind of like the sad part as a reader today. It was easier to be a reader back then when you never knew about all that shit. all you cared about is what was going to happen to Hank Pym the next issue.
There was no good old days. That's the thing that cracks me up when I hear, you know, people talk about how what the good old days were. Like those books you liked were mistakes. Like they weren't meant to happen. They were things that happened on a whim because they threw so much shit against the wall and certain things clicked and certain things didn't. And that's just how it was. It was never a thing where they sat there and they planned out all this kind of stuff. It was just quick.
Oh yeah, back in the day that Now, I don't know if it's so much now, but if you go back 10 years, they'd have those big conferences and plot out like what was going to happen to Superman over the next year or what was going to happen to Batman. And they had all these creative teams around the round table. And
Yeah, Superman was one of the ones, first ones to do stuff like that when it had Wheezy and Byrne and had Dan Jurgens, like a whole bunch of them getting together. And they did it on their own, I think. They were basically, they wanted to keep the books.
Yeah, and then Marvel started to do those big conferences with Bendis and all those guys. Now I don't know so much if they exist anymore.
Oh, they still do it. It depends on the groups, but not everybody gets invited. I mean, it'll be like Hickman, Bendis, you know, the big names, Hickman, Bendis, blah, 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 Aaron, you know, Jason Aaron, like they would get together. But if you're not a big name or you're not put, you know, like you're not favored, I would say, in the editor's office. And if your book is not part of, and another thing, if your book is not part of the mainstream story, like if they don't feel like the book is important to the universe, because everybody, you know, I hear a lot of complaints about, oh, we need to, you know, I hate when they keep getting disturbed by other crossovers and stuff, and oh, I get sick of that. I wish they would just let the guy do his own story in the corner. You know what happens to those books when they do their own story in the corner? Like Fearless Defenders, they get canceled.
Yeah.
Because people look at it and they go, hey, this book is, let me see, this book.
It also has to do with the characters they put in the books, though.
Unfortunately,
like Fearless Defenders is pretty freaking well done. Like it is a very ongoing serial book that has a lot of B-list females,
mm-hmm.
or C-list females, but it's well done. Like, I mean, it's
but even thought of as not important.
Well, I think there's fans, and then there's other people like me that got to have everything. But the people that read everything or want to read everything, they get the benefit because they get these stories, even though these characters they don't. But if you're limited in your budget and you still want to follow the main character,
mm-hmm.
you're going to drop those minor ones.
Yeah, it's like a catch-22.
Yeah, but even back in the day, it didn't seem like there were that many titles. if you go back in the Bronze Age, it sure would be easier to be a completist back then.
Yeah, there weren't as many.
They had less Marvel titles. They were all tightly joined. I just like even this one says, "Oh, Spider-Man's having problems with Peter Parker's at his aunt's house. He's worried about her. He's like, I can't go out and fight the Zodiac."
Yeah, it was tighter. It was a lot easier to keep the world more tighter.
Now it'd
be like more 25 books or something like that.
I think attitudes have changed in work ethic, and I hate to say that, but I think people will speak out a lot more now than they did back in the day. Back then, they were happy to get a paycheck and go to work, and then.
Well, then there were no indie scene for you to run to.
Right, you had nothing else to run to. You were paid to go in and do your job, and now it's a little bit different. Like I'm sure a lot of people that still have that work ethic, but they also have like I can do this on my own. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I can go to Image. I can go to IDW. I could go to this place to get my. Or I could kickstart this. I mean, there's a lot more options,
and you had time to think. Like you didn't get an email and get pissed off, and then pop over to the other tab in your browser on Twitter and say "fuck this person, fuck that person."
Yeah, none of that.
You had to write a letter or something, and it would have to go into the mail, and it would take a while. Or you actually have to put some effort into it, and by then you might relax and think. This
So glad you mentioned that because. I've gotten better at that, but man, there was times when I get a fucking email and I just want to reply immediately like, that's the stupidest idea I've ever seen. But if I sit upon it and think about it and make the right email, it's the right choice, especially when it involves your career.
Damn right. Yeah.
But it's so immediate. Sometimes you get emotional or it's easier to do, like you said, then you have time to cool your jets.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, those joint emails are a bitch. I've had at my job, that's happened before where somebody sent out a joint email and was only supposed to go to two or three people.
Or if they forward it And the person that forwards it, in other words, your intent was to talk to two or three people internally, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not meant to be shared with somebody else. And then some stupid person decides to forward it without asking you. That's the worst.
The reply to all.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody sends out a mass email, and then somebody who doesn't really understand technology responds to all instead of one person. And that was like, at my job, this woman did that. She did reply to all. She meant to just send it back to the original sender and like congratulated him on his new baby, and he hadn't told really that many people.
Oops.
I saw him. I'm like, so did she break the news for you? And he said, yeah, pretty much.
I know you're having that affair with that other woman, and you have that new baby coming along.
Yeah, at least it wasn't anything that bad.
At all.
Yeah.
Oops.
At least it wasn't that bad, but yeah.
It happens. It's so immediate now with the way that social media is that you can call somebody out really quick, and then but you got to think about it. You call that person out. Today, that editor that you called out of DC, you go to Image, and Image will hire that same editor down the line. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, shit.
You really got to be professional, because you never know who your boss is going to be.
You don't, because it's so interchangeable. People leave all the time. Like, Mike Martz.
That's a general rule across any discipline, though.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, even if you're in the technology and you move from company to company, that guy you didn't get along with might be your new boss. You know?
That's right.
It's better to just keep – don't burn bridges and just move on with the flow if you can.
Hold it in.
That's the key, if you can.
Just hold that shit in. You want to say, you motherfucking piece of – but you just, it's better to just hold it in for now.
Mm-hmm.
And just and then, say, you know, this company wanted to go in a different direction than me. And I, you know, and that's all it was. No big deal.
Yeah. And you see it, because the comic industry, I mean, those are people doing their jobs. And just like we have jobs, it's just, you don't have this fandom out there that's interested in our jobs, you know, at least as far as I'm aware. I don't have a fandom that's interested in my job. So
no, I'm not even interested in my job.
Should be frightening. Yeah, exactly. But and so you see throughout these past couple of years, you could point to that's so such and such person. They didn't really make the right move there. And then you see someone come along that, you know, they do leave on amicable terms, like, you look at John Layman.
Yeah, I was just thinking about Layman.
Recently,
he basically, yeah. There's been a couple of people that have left, like John Layman. They said, you know, my contract's up. I appreciate what DC gave me, and I'm going to do my own thing now.
Yep.
It was like, they're not treating me bad. I'm getting a good paycheck, and
I'm not going to burn any bridges
and
here.
And there's something like Rob Liefeld, when you go out and you like shit all over 20 or so people, and you'll never get a job with those 20 or so people again.
Yeah. Well, and in every business, there's some people that are mentally unstable. So that's all I'm going to say about Rob Liefeld.
Well, you know, when you make $1 million in the bank, like,
exactly,
you're a multimillionaire, it's easy to get angry, because I was shit all over my job. I was rich.
He's got that.
Right. If you always have, if you're already well to do. It's easier to leave something than if you need to worry about who's going to – the food on your table the next week.
Yeah.
But then the Mike Fultons, who he brought in with him, you know, they get left out.
Yeah.
Because when they go, well, I ain't fucking with none of the people you brought in, then how about that? You know, and
that really sucks for Mark, because
exactly.
Fulton, I think, was making the hell of the good decisions on Hawkman.
Yeah, he was working hard and getting Hawkman back on track.
Yeah,
and you get punished.
Bringing back into it, bringing Hawkgirl back in.
Right. So you don't. Everybody don't need you to be the cheerleader. You don't need to be the, like, if they ask you to say something, that's one thing. But when they leave, that doesn't mean nobody asked you to use them as an example of why this company sucks that I don't like. Like, that's not, because you don't know the reasons. Like, you're not there, you don't know. And it's funny because sometimes I do know some of the people that have gone through stuff, and I talk to them, and I know what happened. But you just, it's not my, you're not your place to say anything. But people jump in for them and put this long story in of how they know how the industry goes, and they're completely wrong.
Yeah, because they just use their own.
They don't have.
But at the same time, you also, when you get those stories, you're getting the perspective of that individual. You're not getting the whole. You're not getting the other guy's story, the editor, or what happened with the emails, or you're getting the creator's view of what they think happened, and it's not always two-sided, is what I'm saying.
No, it's never. It's never. It's always, you know, it's always two-sided. And then there's Keith's story.
Keith is amazing, and George Perez even recognized him by posting his art of Sancho, you know, Garcia.
Who is that?
Don Quixote.
And Sancho.
Well, anyway, he actually said that he went to a play or something and brought tear to his eyes, and it brought Keith's picture in it. And that's pretty freaking awesome, because that's what sticks out in an artist's eye, is like, this guy asked for Don Quixote, and everybody's asking for Superman or a Teen Titan or somebody. And who's going to ask for Don Quixote? Keith is unique. He's a very unique individual.
Oh, yeah, the characters he picked. Because he ran to tell us it was Sasho Pasho something.
Yeah.
I'm looking at him like, who?
Yeah, I was just looking why Superman was flying up his ass. I was like, why is Superman in the corner flying up his ass?
I don't know what you're talking about. I'm not cultured, Keith, like you are. I don't know what this is. I don't know art.
But anyway, we got to wrap this up because I got to start Geek Brunch. So
that's right. Get to that vegan food.
Back to bay.
So
much.
So, Daryl, anything you want to plug before we wind this up?
No, just whatever. Well, buy Avengers. Read it. Read old stuff. Buy comics. Buy anything. Buy any comics you want. Read them.
Yeah, whatever
read
you
the
love.
The ones you want. Yeah, read the ones you love.
Yeah, read the comics you enjoy and don't complain about the ones you don't like.
You never see coming.
All right, this has been Retrocast episode 26. And you can reach us at geekbrunchpodcast.com, at MythMakingETC on Twitter. That's how to get a hold of Chris. And at Mike Myers Brunch, that's how to get a hold of me. If you want to get a hold of Daryl, it's at The Voice 123. And what else? We can find us on Forum for Geeks. And also,
not really, though.
Not really. It's kind of died, but I should put it out there anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Just lazy. We have a Facebook page. I'm way more active on that page than anything else.
Yeah, all that posting all the time with those comic things you do.
Yes,
you're a comic lover. What's wrong with you?
Overwhelming those Facebook groups with your spam.
I just hate it, man.
I got reprimanded yesterday, so I just left that group.
You know what you need to do? You need to post more sexy ladies.
Well, I do that on my own page.
No, you need to do it everywhere. You need to post it on my page, on Keith's page. Keith loves it.
Yeah, Keith hates it. I'll tag him, and there'll be some ass.
Tag him.
Gonna kill him.
I got a picture of a bare ass. Somebody just sent me a picture of a girl's bare ass, and they painted the Death Star on it. I gotta give it to you. It's gotta be discussed on DC Noise.
Yeah, we gotta put that. That'll be the. I want to see that, and then I'll make it the logo for the next episode.
Oh, Keith loves when you do that. And then you post the episode on his wall. He loves that.
That's right. He doesn't promote it. He's the only podcaster I know that's like hides.
He tells people not to listen.
Yes, please don't listen to our show.
No one.
I don't. Can you think of anybody else that says that? I can't.
I don't know of
any other podcaster that says, I don't want you to know I don't want anybody. That's because worlds collide.
As a secret. And
in this case, they've collided. And he doesn't want anybody to know what his drunken ass is saying.
Well, you had a good suggestion to him in a recent episode where you were like, well, why are you using your real name then?
Yeah.
He used to change it to Don Quixote.
Don Quixote.
Yeah.
We've just lost Keith and we have a new guy on the show. His name is Don Quixote.
And he likes asses.
And he can make his own Facebook page called Don Quixote.
Mm-hmm. And just say, you know, he's an even better impersonator than Robert Atkins. It's just a coincidence. Right. That he sounds exactly like Keith Knudsen.
We can use that old picture of him, the one that looks like he looks Spanish. Oh,
the criminal one?
Yes, the one that looks like he got out of jail.
So he looks more like Don Quixote and put on one of those hats.
Yeah, or he could say that his name is Jesus Christ.
That's right.
We could definitely Photoshop that. We could fix that up. There are ways.
All right. So do you want to plug your podcast, Chris, real quick?
Mythmaking, et cetera. It's mythmakingetc.com. It's on iTunes. And this last episode, I talked some more about the Epic Collections, the ones that are coming up and what they have in it. And then I been looking at early 80s Green Lantern on there, but I'm going to start an ongoing series that I'll do periodically where I'm looking at Wally West, calling it From Kid to Flash. And looking at how he went from being the sidekick to the superhero, so because he's a favorite of mine. So I think the next episode will be looking at his first appearances. Young Wally.
Sounds good. And yeah. You can find me at Geek Brunch, Geek Brunch Podcast, and Valiant Podcast, and DC Noise. I got four. I don't have as much as Daryl, but I'm getting up there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, you guys have a good week, and I'll talk to you guys soon.
All right.
Beady, beady, beady. All right.
Thanks for joining us, Dara.
Do you like how Twiggy is starting to use terminology that Buck's giving him?
I know. He's using old phrases.
Yeah.
He said to Dr. Theophilus, "Get off my back."
And he said, Theophilus said, "I am not on your back. I am on your front."
I don't understand you.
All right. Have a good one.
All right. Bye.
My favorite song. Across the universe, la 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 la.
Words are flowing out like endless rain into a paper cup. They slither while they pass, they slip away across the universe. Pools of sorrow, waves of joy are drifting through my opened mind, possessing and caressing me. Change my world. Nothing's gonna change.